Welcome to a regular meeting of Chelan County PUD. It is September 6th, 2016, and we are at 10:03 for our start time. We have three commissioners present, and we have Commissioner Bergman on phone. And we'd like to thank Commissioner Bergman for doing a little modeling for the rest of us today. He's not feeling well and decided not to bring whatever his discomfort is in and share it with the rest of us. And
apparently we don't have him just yet.
We don't have him yet. Well, you'll have to tell him. I actually complimented him.
It's recorded.
there's proof. There's proof that actually I made the effort to. So let me know when he's available, please.
So, Commissioner, if I could maybe just take a moment to mention that we do have Teresa Boucher at the table today. We want Sheila to occasionally be able to take a vacation, and so we're trying to make sure that we've got some other capability here that can manage through board meetings.
I actually thought what it was is there was somebody else chairing the meeting today, and there was a fear that we'd need backup. And so it'll take two, I'm sure. Thank you for being here. Good morning, Mr. Bergman.
Good morning.
Hey, I passed a little compliment to you a little bit ago. Thanks for modeling that you don't bring your discomfort of an illness into a meeting, and much appreciated, and thank you for doing that. So there are four commissioners present today. Mr. Smith is out on business. And if you choose to address the commission this morning, and we encourage you to do so, please use our microphone and give us your name and your address, because our meetings are recorded, and that allows the public to know the players without a program. And if you have a cell phone, would you please put it in some kind of a rest position so that it doesn't disturb the meeting? With that being said, one thing, it would be better for us as commissioners. We do pretty well in the morning leaning forward into our microphones so that the recordings are very clear. In the afternoon after lunch, we have a tendency to lean away from them. And the afternoon meetings are not having quite the same quality of sound as our morning ones. So if we could be cognizant of that, that'd be great. With all that being said, Safety Minute, Pledge of Allegiance by Bill Kaminsky.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
My name is Bill Kaminsky. I'm with the Security Department here at the PUD.
And I'd just like to talk to you a little bit today about awareness as a factor of safety. Merriam-Webster says that awareness is knowing that something, such as a situation, condition, or problem, exists. But being distracted means you're unable to think about or pay attention to something, or you're unable to concentrate. It seems like there's too many things nowadays that kind of take our concentration away from what we are doing at any given moment. Let's take driving, for example. At safestart.com, there's the top 10 causes of distracted driving accidents, listing such things as using vehicle controls, which is 1%, eating or drinking causes 2%. These two last two were really surprising to me. Cell phone use only causes 12% of accidents, but being generally distracted or lost in thought causes 62%. Really? Lost in thought. But like to concentrate on cell phones, that Pokemon Go game has led to a lot of really dangerous situations, and they're all related to a lack of awareness of your situation. Some headlines that have come up, two California men fell off Ocean Bluff, 75 to 100 feet, two men playing this game, teens robbed at gunpoint, Florida man shoots at teens he mistakes for thieves, unaware that they are trespassing. Just in closing, I'd like to leave you with a situation that was personal to me, where my awareness kept me out of something that I felt was pretty bad. Early 90s, I lived in San Francisco, lived downtown, worked downtown. One night after work, I'm going home, it's getting dark, and about 25 feet ahead of me, there's two gentlemen walking down the street, same direction I'm headed. One of them kind of looks back at me like that and says something. And the other guy looks back at me, and I'm going like, this is kind of odd. And sure enough, I'm getting ready to take a left down my corner down to my apartment. And these two guys turn down the same street. I'm like, oh, this is nuts. I get to the corner. One of the guys has stopped at the bus stop, and the other has continued to walk. And all I knew at that point in time was I did not want to be between them. I didn't want to have somebody behind me and somebody in front. So all I did was I just stopped, and I looked at the guy at the bus stop. He had his back to me. I just stopped there, and I waited several moments. And finally, this guy looks back to see, evidently, where am I? He looks back at me, sees me standing at the corner, gives me the thumbs up, and starts walking down the street to meet up with his friend. So awareness is very key for your personal safety, as well as the safety of those around you. These people playing Pokemon and whatnot, they kind of need our help. So, anyways, that's my safety minute.
Thank you. Appreciate
you.
It,
nice
Bill.
Job, Bill.
Any questions, comments for Bill? Perfect. Thank you very much. Let's take a look at our agenda, please. Approval of the agenda. Any item on the regular agenda that we want to transfer to consent agenda is possible at this point from any of the commissioners?
I think this is the time where I would like to ask that we move. Can we just do some shifting at this point?
Sure.
Move manager items up on the regular business session, the afternoon PM session.
Okay.
Just move them to the top of the regular agenda.
Right.
Because I have a quick doctor's appointment at 1, and I'll hustle back here. And I know the manager items already. So, but I want to be here for the resolutions. So if we could change the agenda and put manager items before item number 9.
All right. Commissioners, any objections?
No.
Okay, we'll reorder the agenda to accommodate that need. Any other adjustments to the agenda? Hearing none, we'll proceed.
Oh, how about
okay.
I'm sorry.
No, nope, that's fine.
Item number 9. Any disagreement with putting that on the consent agenda?
Okay. Item 9 is a resolution.
Yeah, yes.
And it's for an...
it's authorizing publication of an RFP.
Yeah, an RFP. And so this is actually... it's an important item. But it does not have, in this current state, a monetary property that makes it significant.
Correct. It's a process resolution.
Process.
In accordance with the delegation resolution of 2008. Any project that might have a value over $3 million is comes before the board for authorization for publication. So.
And the decision whether to accept the RFP comes at the back end of the process.
Right.
What
mm-hmm. Right.
What the contractors bring in, so that's the important part in that process.
Yeah, okay. This just establishes the sending out of the RFP.
Correct.
Any objections?
No.
Hearing none, we'll move that then into the consent agenda.
Thank you.
Any other items? All right. Number 3, Mr. Wright, please.
We want to invite our friends from Localtel up, Dimitri Mandelis. I think he might have some of his colleagues with him as well, and Mike Coleman, to come up and talk about the television conversion update that we've been hearing about for the last month.
Good morning, Commissioners. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom. Back on August 1st, Dimitri and Eric gave you all a complete update on the conversion that was happening August 22nd, the digital channel conversion. I don't think it's a surprise that the conversion was viewed as being very, very successful, but we thought it would be useful to have Dimitri come back and give you a complete update after the conversion was over. And without stealing any of his thunder, not only was it successful, from the district's perspective, it was handled extremely well. They did a tremendous amount of outreach. As always, not everybody reads their outreach, so there were some phone calls. But Localtel did a fantastic job of handling all of the phone calls And to the best of my knowledge, we did not receive a single overflow phone call to the district. So that is something to applaud them for. I will do that. A lot of preparatory work went into this. I think the key things were both the outreach and the technical preparation. It was a very complex, very technical conversion that had to take place. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Dimitri to go through that.
Hello, I'm Dimitri Mandelas from LocalTel 341 Grant Road. The last time I was here, I was explaining that we were getting ready to do this digital upgrade. We did it on August 22nd at midnight. It, from the very beginning, looked like it was going to go very well, but we knew we would have a lot of phone calls that day. And in fact, we did. We set new records for phone calls, even with all the outreach we did. Mostly the calls were how to scan their TV sets. They had flat panel TV sets. So to remind you, what we did was we went all digital. Before that, the first 80 channels were all analog. And so they were the old look, the old 4x3 shape to the TV, the SD stuff. And for every, just to remind you, the reason why we did this was that for every SD channel or analog channel we removed, we could put 2.5 HD channels in its place. And we were full up on all the frequencies, so we really couldn't add any more TV unless we did this. Plus, not very many people were actually watching the SD channels. Most of them were going into the 500 ranges or to the exotic channels on their set, on their TVs to find the HD channels. So this allowed us to line up so that all the TV channels that are on the set-top box are the same number on the TV set now, and they're HD. So this was a great upgrade. It'll allow us to add another 80 channels, which we've already added
40
HD channels. And some of them are going from SD to HD, and some are new channels. And we have more to go. So we spent most of Monday, that Monday, helping people convert from SD to HD. And we also have a little called a DTA. And for those people who have the older set-top box and didn't want to get rid of the older TV but did not want to get rid of it, this converted it from an analog to from a digital signal to an analog signal for their old TV. We weren't quite sure how many customers would want them, but we went through 1,000 of them. Okay, so there's 1,000 older TV sets out in the Chelan County PD area that are still being used. Normally, our normal incoming call list is about, call numbers are around, about 1,200 to 1,400 a day. We took almost 3,600 that day. And what I found interesting was our extension-to-extension calls, which are two employees talking to each other, hit 10,000 that day. So there was a lot of switching people between departments to try to get them up and going. The call volume dropped from Monday through Friday. So by the Friday, we were back down to about 1,000 calls per day. So it's about 250. And we're still running at about that pace. There's still a lot of people who have not switched over their older TV sets. Most people are, I think, were really happy. A lot of them had a flat panel but never saw the HD channels on it because they didn't know how to get them. So they think we actually added a new HD version to some of these channels. They were already there, but they just didn't have an easy way to do it. And having them align up makes it easier. You know, if you see that the, you know, Fox News is on channel 88, it's also channel 88 on your TV set if you don't have a set-top box, which just makes it kind of nice. So we still have some issues to deal with, to be honest. Some of the DTAs, and we're finding that some of the homes, just even though their TV sets are ready, their internal wiring really wasn't very ready. So we're going out and doing still quite a bit of that, but way less than we did that first day. So we feel like a success. We're starting probably in a week or two to go to our next phase, which will be to bring in the multicast and the mobile pieces to this lineup, so that if you go to channel 88 on your iPad, it's Fox News on that. Okay, and it'll be the same as on your TV set or on your set-top box. Some people weren't that happy either. We lost a few customers. Some don't want to not use their VCRs and stuff. And so we don't have an option for them, unfortunately. They're not willing to take the DTA, so we really can't help them much. And one of the happiest groups I think I run into were the Costco salespeople who have called and thanked us for all the TV sets they've sold. And in fact, I went up and bought one for my office because it didn't work. And so I went up there, got a $100 TV set, and it's just beautiful. So how did it go for you? All you have, I think, are of our TVs. How's mm-hmm. Did it? You're not on it. Okay.
Sorry.
That's all right. That's all right. Did it go okay?
Well,
yeah. I did. We have one where my wife has her exercise, and I kept thinking, then I had to just simply reset the scan, and it picked it up, and things were fine, and she was happy, and I was happy. What I guess I appreciate most, maybe it's because of just being simple, is that I think the groupings where you have the news stations closer together, the sports stations closer together, the networks closer together. When I'm channel surfing, I now surf by group rather than individual. So it's a lazy man's approval of something I think you did well.
Well, you can thank Eric for it.
Thank you, Eric.
Eric, do you want to say anything? Eric was responsible for the last year. It took us a year to do this. And I can't overestimate or underestimate how complicated this was, and could not have done it without him, which is why I've had him come. And
I don't have too much to add. It was a long time coming. I got a lot of help when we first acquired the head end from the PUD techs who've been working with it, and just kind of walking us through what each step did and how to maintain it and keep it going. That was probably the biggest challenge for me, was to have something that's a living organism that everyone's working off of, but at the same time get it prepped to do this big cutover without affecting current customers at the same time. And so it was kind of a juggling act on improving it and keeping it running while at the same time getting ready to do this mass undertaking. And there's a lot of support from the PD and from everyone to get that ready. So I really appreciate all that, and happy that we're actually able to sit here and take a deep breath.
I bet you are breathing easier.
Yeah.
So, hand for Eric. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thanks, Eric.
For all the work.
Commissioner Bergeron, any thoughts or comments?
No, not really, other than the fact that I think when you go through a transition as important as the one we just saw and have it go so smoothly, just shows the prep work that went into it, the collaboration between the PUD and Locotel. And it just went very, very smooth, and I would like to congratulate Locotel and our own PUD for doing a great job.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. Anyone else care to comment? No.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks to everyone.
Thank you, guys. Good job.
Item 4, Mr. Wright.
We want to invite the folks from the city to come over. Jeff Smith's going to introduce this, talk about the North Wenatchee Master Plan.
Brenda, thank you for coming.
No stranger to you. At the table is Steve King, the Director of Community and Economic Development for the city, and Mayor Frank Kuntz is here, Administrative Services Director Allison Williams as well, and as Steve indicated, they're here to share information about the North Wenatchee Master Plan. Steve.
Thank you, Jeff. Well, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to come and present to you. Before I get started, probably ought to back up a year to just after the Sleepy Hollow fires and the fairly sizable area of destruction that happened in North Wenatchee. We saw this as, a disaster, obviously, but quickly wanted to react to it in a way to create an opportunity. And so we went back to Olympia and presented to the State Community Economic Revitalization Board for some funding to master plan the area that was destroyed. And so we hired a consultant this last year, and they've been working hard and diligently to develop a master plan with the goal of creating the best opportunity for our limited land base in Wenatchee as possible. This is a pretty special area next to the Horan Wetlands and the park, and an extension of our waterfront, actually part of our waterfront plan, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. So on June 7th, our consultant Crandall Rambula came to town and presented their couple of options for us. And since then, we've been working with our stakeholder groups, PUD, Stamilt, Northwest Wholesale, DOT, and city departments to develop a to basically vet the plan to see if it's viable or not. So we're in that process right now. So there is the area that was impacted by the fires. DOT is wasn't impacted, but they're relocating out to Old Station. They plan on vacating the site in April of 2018. Northwest Wholesale was impacted. Stamilt owns, see if I have a pointer, I do, this property here and this property here, and then the PUD owns this property. So that area is represents about 50 acres of property, and it's very unusual to have an opportunity in a place like Wenatchee or in a confined city like Wenatchee to master plan 50 acres of property. So this, again, trying to take the best chance to make an opportunity out of something that was pretty negative. I have to admit that the state, both Department of Commerce through the CURB Board and through Public Works Trust Board, are very interested in this effort and gave us a lot of enthusiasm when we've been working with them through this process. Nice to see state support, see their cities reacting to a problem in a positive manner. Our consultants developed two plans. One was a base option, a kind of a minimalist plan. And the second was a preferred option with the option or opportunity to maximize the intensity of urban development. So we compared against the two options. The preferred option has risen to the surface as being what we're calling the McKittrick alternative, and you'll see why in a minute. So I'll be presenting on the McKittrick alternative. The base option is basically leave things as it is, pretty much, in terms of infrastructure, and let it to redevelop more in a just kind of as development in the market drives it. The McKittrick option is a little bit more intensive and is actually representative of a true master planning effort. So the McKittrick option, if you were to hover over McKittrick Street Grocery Outlet, this is the view you'd be looking at if you look towards the park. And the reason why it's called the McKittrick option is it takes an underpass under McKittrick Street down towards the Horan Wetlands. Previously, the underpass has been planned for Holly Street. And for obvious reasons, this underpass would go right through those Stamilt warehouses if they hadn't been destroyed. So we got to look at this area with a blank piece of, as a blank piece of paper, which was a true pleasure to really look at what makes the most sense and how do you maximize the use of properties. And most people, when they think of underpass, think of Fifth Street or maybe Holly's or Thurston Street and pigeons and dark and graffiti. And so our consultants wanted to make sure that we recognize that there are ways to do underpasses that create a gateway and are non-threatening. This is an underpass under I-84 in the Dalles. Graffiti, resilient, lit, and actually an inviting place rather than a scary place. The principle behind redevelopment or master planning in this area is, and I'm really specifically talking about east or west, east of the tracks on the water side of the tracks, is to create the ideal district. And an ideal district is one that has a little bit of commercial to support residential and a high number of residential and some employment within walking distance. This is the national trend in urbanism, is to live close to where you work and give the opportunity to live in an urban environment. And we don't have a lot of that options in Wenatchee right now. We have a lot of single family homes and neighborhoods, and that's great, but this has an opportunity to provide a different development pattern that maybe attracts some diversity in our economy. So the ideal district, again, centralized, a little bit of commercial, restaurants, coffee shops, that sort of thing to support the surrounding residential area with some working close at hand. This is the development pattern that we would anticipate, 3 to 6 story buildings. This would be an example of that small commercial area, mixed-use development on the ground floor. One thing that's different about 10 years ago is, people are recognizing how Amazon affects the commercial environment, and so you don't put mixed use everywhere. You put it in very focused locations where it can be maximized. Otherwise, you're left with a lot of ground floor sitting empty. So that's the intent behind this. And this would be actually the short section of McKittrick Street. You'll see in a second how it fits. Again, a little bit of a commercial area for to support the residential, and then more of a townhome condo type development pattern. See a lot of this in the Mill District in Bend. If you go down there, it looks very familiar. They're proposing that there be a small urban park in the redevelopment of this area, and you might ask, why do you have a park next to the wonderful PUD park? Well, the PUD park in that area is very much geared towards recreation with the ball fields. So this is an urban park that would have the kid toys and maybe a splash pad or, you know, picnic tables and be very focused for the residential area. And one thing about creating a park in the middle of a residential area is it adds more frontage to the buildings. So you always have the backside of the buildings. Well, it changes it so you have frontage. You look out on the park instead of at the street or the neighboring building. Again, urban parks. This is an example of the opportunities for employment and business. And what they're calling this is flex or light industry / office space. And so you're building these buildings to maximize the opportunities for various types of uses. A lot of folks, especially startup businesses, need a little bit of garage space along with their office. And so, for example, that top building allows some shipping of things, like Orchard Corset started in a very similar situation, as an example. And then, you know, as office demand, you know, Class A office is in pretty good demand around the city. We have quite a bit of other office space that isn't in so much demand. So looking at those options and really evaluating the market as we build out the employment center. When we compare the base case, which again is very much as is, we're looking at these various square footages. And the one I want to focus on, the residential commercial kind of all are roughly the same, a little bit different. But in the base case, there's more of a development in the industrial pattern, kind of like it is, whereas in the McKittrick option, there's more of a residential element. One of the things we realize is in order to help address the massive challenges we have with North Wenatchee Avenue, you want to create living in the city so people aren't traveling that road as much into the heart of the city. So that the McKittrick alternative, now we're hovering over the river looking back towards Wenatchee Avenue and the railroad tracks. And so this is the Horan Nature Trail. Here's the park, the ball fields. Here's the current PUD Holly Street Yards. And I'll just walk through how the development pattern looks. Focus residential closest to the park. Obviously, you want to max, that's the highest value property. There's that short block of commercial area that has ground floor commercial to support the residential. And that residential represents about 600 units, maybe pushing up the 850 units, depending on the demand, market demand, and the how this development develops. This pattern includes parking structures underneath, and so you're looking at a different development pattern than, like, for example, Riverside 9. They call them podium style construction. There's the flex space, which would be closer to the tracks, providing some buffer. You leave your parking and back along the tracks. And then the professional office is shown on the corner of the PUD property. And at the time we were kicking this off, Dan Frazier was helping us with this and talking a little bit about this PUD planning process. So for an option, they basically took the square footage and said, what if the PUD located their main facility here? And that's what you see in the professional office, a considerable amount of professional office there. If the PUD did not do that, that's okay. It's not, the plan does not hinge on it. If the PUD stayed with the way it was, that's fine. If the PUD were to try to surplus that property, it might be better off residential, adding a little bit more residential units. Again, you've heard our mayor talk about the housing crisis, and so this would help us with that. There's where the light industrial, we see the light industrial going back against the tracks. Near the Michelson packaging area. me step back real quick on the commercial. So the commercial along Wenatchee Avenue is pretty easy to accomplish. A lot of demand. That's our highest value property in the city, and we have a lot of we've been working with Center Oak properties to help understand the market, and so we see an opportunity for big box and retail, and we have hotel demand. Anything along North Wenatchee Avenue is pretty easy to achieve. And one of the keys is that gives us the tax revenue to help build the infrastructure. So when I talk a little bit about infrastructure and some of the numbers that you'll see, it's really important that we have that redevelopment on the DOT and Northwest Wholesale site. It helps us with tax increment financing and building of the infrastructure. So in plan view, this is how it all looks. Here's McKittrick Street right here. Going across, there's the little commercial area, residential along the park. And there's some road realignments. I'll show you a little more detail on that. Here's the PUD property here. And how does this, before I get into much more detail, I just want to say we looked at how this relates to our existing plans. You may remember the waterfront plan. This area is included in the waterfront plan. Here's the Holly Street grade separation that we talked about. And then the waterfront plan included an extension of Walla Walla Street right along the park and then cut over to Holly Street. So this is a very similar plan to the waterfront plan, just a little different land configuration. We also looked at the Confluence Parkway plan, which is part of the North Wenatchee remedy long term. And the current North Confluence Parkway plan shows a grade separation at Miller Street, following Miller, and then going out along the wetland side of the PUD property to connect back along the railroad tracks and cross the Wenatchee River with another bridge. That's a very intense, ambitious plan, and the Transportation Council is doing some studies on the environmental impacts on that now. That we don't want to preclude that plan from happening with this development. In fact, we want to actually enhance the opportunity, if we can, for the Confluence Parkway. So this is how we look at revising our plan. So if Confluence Parkway comes for comes to be, then this still works very well as Confluence Parkway. It just moves the road away from the wetlands and puts it along the tracks. And Holly Street, because you have a grade separation here at McKittrick, Holly Street would actually go away. Burlington Northern loves to see grades or at grade crossings go away for safety reasons. Some other improvements is a little bit of park expansion here at the corner where the trail enters. I think it's where it enters the state park area. We also have proposed some park expansion right in front of Dovex, because that's a real central point. In fact, talking with our partners to Milt, they would like to see this themed based off the Miller Trading Post. They found the old plaque down in the weeds when they were developing that property, and there's a historical marker right on the trail there. Pretty significant significance in our valley's history, especially with the confluence being the Native Americans trading area. So from an infrastructure standpoint, here's the big changes. Those are the main backbone roads as they exist today, with the dotted line being the railroad track. And so what we're proposing is to realign Miller and Holly Street a little bit, push it back away from the park. Again, that helps with Confluence Parkway, and it also maximizes property along the park. And then we'd extend Walla Walla Street over to McKittrick here. Instead of going along the park like this, we would just go straight with it. And so we've put in a request for Public Works Trust Funds loans and a TIB grant to do these two elements, because the Public Works Trust Fund program gives some preferences to disaster recovery. So this was an opportunity we had to capitalize on. We're doing this a little bit ahead of actual adoption of this plan, but we recognize from a timing perspective we need to be ready if these funds become available. And the last segment of infrastructure is the big one, and that is getting a grade separation across to McKittrick Street. I want to add that we already have McKittrick Street signal funded with a stub out road already planned here, even prior to this whole plan developing, because we know that Northwest Wholesale area needs better access. So from an investment standpoint, all these buildings, with the intensity specified represents about a $300 million private investment effort, and we're looking at $35 to $50 million of public investment. Right now we're at $37 million. I always add a little bit extra because things come up when you don't expect it. So we want to make sure that we're in a ratio that's specified there, six to one. Better than 6 to 1 is our goal from a public-private investment standpoint. And so it looks like we can easily exceed that investment ratio. And I want to add that that's a big number, but we already have a funding scenario lined up for about for this entire area, North Wenatchee Avenue, and out down here, pushing about $60 million, because we already have $23 million that's funded for North Wenatchee Avenue after the last legislative round with the Connecting Washington's money. So we're already on path to about a $60 to $70 million investment track here, and we're hopeful of getting some tax increment financing legislation passed, just like we did on the waterfront, to help us with the rest of it. And so it's very feasible from a public infrastructure standpoint, and we're looking at the marketability. With rents at Riverside 9 pushing $2,000 for a two-bedroom apartment, the market is here to support this type of construction, podium style with parking, covered parking type construction.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Quickly. Based on that, the assumption is this would not be low-income housing?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
We have we just finished up a housing study, which was really fascinating, to try to understand what our housing crisis consists of. And what we found, and it kind of makes sense when you think back about it, is that we have a surplus of units that should be affordable housing for market rate workforce housing, and we have a deficiency of units that are newer, nicer, more upper-end market rate, which is evident by the popularity of Riverside 9. They're the only newer place in town. And, of course, they're just slammed with a waiting list, and even with despite the higher rents. So what we need most desperately in our valley right now is market rate housing to lift down renting. So if you don't have market rate housing, you rent the older people rent the older stock, which creates a demand that puts it out of range for in more affordable housing. So it's an interesting scenario. Other cities have the reverse problem where they have plenty of market rate but not enough affordable. So they do more public housing. And so that's actually an easier problem to solve if you can get some land ready to go like this with the market rate approach.
Thoughts, comments, questions for Steve?
Mr. Zim, I might just take a second and say I maintain a pretty regular dialogue with Mayor Kuntz about things that are going on in the area, and conversations about opportunities for us to be able to work together to better serve all of our constituents. And have kept them informed with respect to the development of our facilities plan so that they know that we are looking at all of our facilities. Here you see some discussion of the Holly Street facility, but, of course, for us, the context will be the larger one about what's the path forward for all of our facilities. We still are in process in terms of developing that. The key criteria for us is best for the most for the longest, what will create the best value for the longest period of time for PUD customer owners, but certainly the Holly Street facility will be a critical component of that discussion, because one of the things that we know today is that about 70% of our trips out to the field go north, and yet we're coming from here. So there are potentially some opportunities here, but at the end of the day, we've got to get through that analysis before we know how our plan relates to what they put up there. And we still have some more work to do before we're going to get to any conclusions on that.
I would say, too, that we are, I mentioned we're vetting this process, so we're working with Northwest Wholesale, DOT, and Stamilt. If the private folks are not interested in this plan, then not much we can do with it. So it's really a partnership effort. The public benefit is a new development type in our city that provides housing options that might be desirable for folks. If there was an attraction of the tech industry, for example, you want to have some different housing types, And just the transition of demographics with baby boomers changing housing demands, millennials. Dennis and I had a great discussion the other day.
That's right. Since I've just done a transition. Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, we're pretty excited about this. It really is a neat opportunity to turn something that was pretty disastrous into something positive.
Other thoughts? Steve, what's the feasibility of the second bridge, working with the State Department of Transportation, et cetera?
The Confluence Parkway Bridge, the Wenatchee River Bridge. The feasibility is being evaluated right now by the Transportation Council in somewhat of a fatal flaws type analysis to look at what are the costs, what are the challenges. You can do anything with enough resources, right? Sure. And so with trying to weigh that out, I think it's actually pretty good at the long term. Wenatchee has two ways in and really could use another option. This development pattern may actually help that. And I think we're looking for, how do you make Confluence Parkway make our community better? So how do you put that along the tracks, maybe to provide some buffering to the wetlands, with some sound walls and whatnot? How do you make things better? And so that's the things we're looking at with Confluence Parkway, as well as it creates a great connection to the Old Station, which is another economic development center. Pretty important economic development center. In fact, if you think of Wenatchee as South Wenatchee, downtown, this area, and Old Station, it's pretty much our city. Mm-hmm. And so really connecting those really is really important to our long-term viability. The question is, how do you make that fit with the wetlands and the parks and the tracks? Yeah.
Okay. Anything else? Mayor Kuntz, Allison?
So, you bet. So, we're looking at 2018 for the development of this frontage area along Wenatchee Avenue. That's when the DOT leaves. That's pretty attainable. I don't see any problem hitting that mark. This area here, we're also looking at potentially best the case would be construction at the same time, simultaneous construction of public infrastructure and private development. Because this is one or two property owners, there's an opportunity to do a development agreement. So that you have surety that the master plan comes and the developer has surety that the public is doing their part of it. And that's our goal is, so 2018 would be desirable to start construction with 2020 to 2022 finish, having a good chunk of it done. There will be some stuff that straggles on in 10-year period, but we'd like to have a good push here in the next 5 years.
I would just also add that this type of a plan ensures the highest intensity and development opportunity for the area. As you know, we've been having more holistic discussions around the need to increase our overall value so that we can bond more for our schools and this sort of thing. If this plan were to come to fruition, the development intensity and the value of that development is much more achievable than if it just remains status quo. And so that's the idea of the value of industrial land versus podium-style commercial construction. The value is tremendously different, and that has a much more important sense to us in terms of our overall assessed value of the county and our ability to do other things. And so as a city, we're really looking at intensively using our land so that we can be a benefit to the remainder of the county in terms of housing, economic development, and all those things.
And we applaud Stemil in their progressive thinking about how they're rebuilding their facility out on 97A. You know, this is a North Wenatchee Avenue, as your facilities plan discussions are, considering, it's tougher and tougher to get bigger trucks and those kind of operations in. It's just the city is growing up. And so Stemil, I think, recognized that as they moved out to 97A.
Okay. Any other thoughts? Comments?
I have one.
Yes, Gary, please.
Steve, on the Confluence Parkway, mm-hmm. will that include large trucks, and do you anticipate that accommodating a large number of vehicles? And if so, you have your residential housing mm-hmm. proposed for that area. Do you see a conflict with that?
I'm really glad you asked that question. The plan for Confluence Parkway is about 12,000 cars a day. And for comparison, North Wenatchee Avenue is running about 35 to 38,000 cars a day right now.
Yeah.
Yes, trucks will take North Wenatchee or Confluence Parkway as the likely preferable route. One thing that's interesting, because our city is changing, is we're seeing a lot less total truck volume in the city as what you would see over like on Sunset Highway, for example, or Highway 2. Interestingly, we asked our consultants about that same question. There's two parts that they brought up that are really important. And one is that this McKittrick Street allows a direct connection to the waterfront, Event Center, Walla Walla Park, and on down. And this traffic volume is actually desired in this area for that little bit of commercial area. Same thing with Confluence Parkway. The key is designing Confluence Parkway with greenery and whatnot to buffer the traffic noise. So if you look in other cities that are reworking their major arterials, that's what they're doing. And you'll see the residential being built up next to it because it is buffered. Large green space, sidewalks, noise, noise or attenuation and control. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Insurance companies would probably be happy because right around Horse Lake Road and Maiden Lane and Wenatchee Avenue every afternoon, we just stack them up and haul them off.
Yeah.
So, any other thoughts, comments? Nice presentation, Steve. Appreciate it very much. And Allison and Frank, appreciate you coming to the meeting and sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you.
Number five, asset management, Mr. Wright.
Yeah, we want to do an update for you on we've made asset management a priority here, trying to develop asset management strategies across the district. And we've had folks that have been working on this for a while. You'll begin to see more of this as you see our capital plans and budget exercises. So we wanted to give you an update on how the development of asset management is coming along at Chelan PUD. Janelle Duffy has been really a key part of this effort for us. And so she's going to help lead us through this discussion.
Yeah, let's give Commissioner Berger a chance to rejoin.
Hello.
Well, you're back.
Oh, I am.
All right. We'll proceed. Okay. What we're moving into right now, Mr. Bergeron, is asset management, and the person speaking will be Janelle Duffy.
Okay. Appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi. Good morning, Commissioners. I'm actually Janelle Ulrich now, so I apologize. Many of you aren't aware of that. I'm the Generation Asset Manager, and I will be presenting with a bevy of other individuals, and we'll introduce them as they come up, as this is a district-wide endeavor. So today we're going to focus on the evolution of asset management at Chelan PUD. But we need to start by asking the question, what do we mean by asset management? International Standards Organization, also known as ISO, defines asset management as coordinated activities of an organization to realize value from assets. And what I'd like to do to put a little more meaning behind this is share with all of you a short video that's called What is Asset Management? That was developed by the Institute of Asset Management, or the IAM. There's going to be a lot of S's instead of Z's, as most of this was developed in Europe. So they aren't typos.
Asset management is defined by ISO 55000 as the coordinated activity of an organization to realize value from assets. But what does that look like? At the simplest level, it means an organization is making the best decisions it can about its assets, based on a clear understanding of its long-term objectives and purpose. Asset management is the discipline that seeks to achieve this. Let's look at what it involves. Traditionally, asset decisions were bound to the life cycle of the asset in question, from its initial creation, through its working life, to its eventual disposal. These are not straightforward decisions. For example, how do you build cost-effective maintenance into the initial design? How do you measure the criticality of this asset to the rest of your portfolio? How can you be sure you even need the asset to begin with? Too often, we see these kinds of decisions being made in isolation from the rest of the business. With asset management, the plans that are made for each asset are always part of a bigger system, which is aligned to the organizational strategy. This alignment must reach down to the people doing the day-to-day work on the assets themselves, including outsourced contractors. Asset management decisions are always part of a learning cycle that constantly monitors and reviews performance based on past decisions and stays abreast of the evolving landscape of risks and opportunities that inform future decisions. So what do these decisions actually look like? Although there's variation between businesses and industries, typically they'll involve balancing the costs, the risks, and the performance of an asset or assets over a particular timescale. The discipline has amassed a huge array of tools and techniques that allow each factor to be understood, measured, and traded with the other factors, giving senior management a menu of options to choose from that they know have taken all relevant information into account. Decisions are only as good as the information they're based on, so an asset managing organization needs to treat its data as a core asset in its own right. There needs to be a simple process for agreeing what information is needed, capturing it, and storing it in one place so that there's only one version of the truth. It's equally true that decisions are only as good as the people making them. This isn't just a matter of capability. At its heart, asset management is about collaborating across disciplines to make the best decisions using all the information and insights available. This is often as much a cultural challenge as a technical one. Organizations that have embraced this way of working have realized phenomenal benefits in terms of cost savings, risk reduction, improved performance, and so on. The IAM is a...
I can cut it off there because we are members of the IAM and the rest of it is a marketing spiel about the IAM. We found them to be a very useful resource indeed. So you see the focus there is really on figuring out how to coordinate risk, balance, and performance to provide value as defined by your strategic plan. So the Institute of Asset Management has this conceptual model called a six-box model. And what I like about it the most is that it uses colors, which make things a little bit easier to get things in boxes and keep them there. Traditionally, asset management was defined by the life cycle delivery portion of this conceptual model. So this is a broadening of the definition of asset management and indeed of the concept of asset management at large. And historically, Chelan PUD has been doing asset management since our inception, and we're quite good at it. And we've spent a good amount of our time focusing on this life cycle delivery, as did all of our peers in the rest of the world. So what we're doing here is broadening our perspective of asset management. I'm going to talk a little bit about what that would look like. So traditional asset management is focused on acquiring assets, operating them, maintaining them, and disposing them here typically when we replace them. But modern asset management is focused on strategic alignment, on risk, and holistic decision making. Traditional asset management was usually conducted locally by the asset owner. In modern asset management, we have dedicated asset management specialists who support the decision makers. And the decision-making group tends to be a bit broader and use some more common information. In traditional asset management, there was a big emphasis on asset registries, manufacturer maintenance, following this is an asset we buy, we put it in our registry, we change the filter when the manufacturer tells us to. Modern asset management emphasizes on optimized maintenance. Maybe we change the filter more frequently when it's older. And strong decision-making of when we make those replacements, and if we make those replacements, that's risk-centric, data-driven, and it's coordinated across the organization and up through the organization. So why do we want to engage in modern asset management right now? We've got a lot going on. Why do we want to put an emphasis on this? And the first reason is for our customer owners. Modern asset management really supports the implementation of your strategic plan, our strategic plan, that describes investing in assets and optimizing our funds that belong to our customer owners with a longer time frame. Indeed, our vision talks about generations to come. This focuses on those generations to come in alignment with our vision. It also optimizes the value of the customer owners in a way that we can provide an enhanced ability to describe why we're making an investment and what the value is of that investment and for a specific investment in a universal way. Next, it ensures that we're more proactive rather than reactive. With the vast majority of our assets, they are not what we would call a run-to-fail asset. It makes sense to intervene before the asset fails on its own because, as you all know from recent events, it's far more costly and time-consuming to respond to something that's failed as opposed to replacing it before it's failed. So the goal here is to continue to work towards calculated replacement timing by taking more risk into account to achieve more proactive and fewer reactive repairs and replacements. And finally, the world is getting more and more complex. We see this in a variety of different ways, but modern asset management has a big risk and review and a lot of strategy behind it that provides that risk interface so that we can quantify risks and make sure that we're using data-driven information to make better decisions so we can consider things like safety, the environment, financial considerations, reliability, and a variety of our different stakeholder information in concert. And it increases the transparency and efficiency by using a common language. There's a big toolbox here that the Institute of Asset Management is bringing forward, and with it comes a lexicon, comes a vocabulary that allows people in different areas to talk about things in the same way and hopefully in a clear, simple way. So where are we, and what do we do next? So what we want to assess, we want to plan, and then we want to start working on that plan. So what you see here is a combination of the Institute of Asset Management conceptual model that we described before. And I mentioned I like the color coding. On the right side of this slide is what's called a maturity matrix. And all a maturity matrix is a way of measuring where an organization is today and comparing it to where that organization ultimately would like to be down the road. So you'll see that each of these boxes has a color, and each of these colors is represented on this maturity matrix, with the blue line being where we, across the organization, viewed ourselves to be at this time and the goal of where we would like to be. And one thing you might notice here is that we're pretty darn close on our life cycle delivery, which again is this piece that we've been doing quite well for a very long period of time. And we've got some more opportunities to grow in other portions of the modern asset management. An example is people and organization. We don't have a really long way to go, but as we know, our people are vitally important to us, internal, external people. And it takes a long time to do really good change management. It takes good leadership, good sponsorship, and good coordination. So that's where we focus next. We went immediately to the concept of governance. Of course, you are our governing body as the board. But when we come within the organization and you've provided to us your strategic plan and the direction that we're all supposed to follow, within the bowels, if you will, of the organization, we have to figure out how we're going to coordinate efficiently, effectively within to make sure that we aren't redundant, to make sure that we're efficient, and to get the best practice information from across the organization. So we created a governance process within, deep inside the organization, that ensures that we are working in a matrixed format. That means we work across the business teams and up and down the business unit teams. We at the top have a senior sponsors team, every one of your managing directors who owns a variety of our assets is on that team. And below them sits the directors that work for them and own and work on those assets, as well as some of our major service providers internal to our organization. And those two groups work together to make sure that we're doing things as in the most common way possible across the organization to provide for roll-ups and efficiency. And it helps with that common language. As we move across, right now we currently have two formalized governance teams, one in generation with the managing director as the sponsor and his leadership, a key group of leadership beneath it, working as that governance team, as well as we have one in customer utilities, same thing with the managing director and then his key leadership just below it. And we are set up so that we can add additional groups if resources become available. It's very important to notice that we have a lot of variety, as you well know, across our business lines. And different things are different for different areas. Some areas are going to want to invest a lot more in modern asset management than other areas based on their issues of the day, their resources, the size of their assets, the complexity of their assets, and other factors. Beneath this, we have working teams that are all working together. And what's really nice about this is Generation may be focusing on a rotor. Well, they can pull in Risk, and Risk can work consistently with Generation on that rotor, as when Customer Utilities maybe wants to work on poles, and they can pull that Risk resource in, and we can be using common practices across the organization. So these working teams are very amorphous, and they rearrange to make sure we're really efficient. Beneath that, it's not beneath, but below that, is a district-wide stakeholder communication team. And what this is a quarterly meeting where anybody internal to Chelan PUD can come once every quarter, and we have a meeting where we give them an update on what we're doing in the different areas and across the organization on asset management, as well as we bring in a specific department or area in the organization to do a presentation on how what their work is, how it relates to asset management. So we've had the seismic group come in, we've had Risk, we've had insurance, and accounting will be presenting later this week on how they relate to asset management. So it creates a broader community of asset management and helps us all stay on the same page. So the thing we did after asset management is we focused on building a framework. We built our framework off of the Institute of Asset Management's recommendations and the ISO, the International Standards Organization's guide. And basically what it is it starts with our strategic plan at the very top. Everything we do is based on the strategic plan to make sure we're staying in alignment. Just beneath that, we developed a commitment. This is a policy statement of sorts that has been endorsed by Steve. I'll share it with you in a moment. That talks about why we're doing asset management and what we're focusing on within it. The layer beneath that is a document that talks about what do we want to do in terms of our capabilities within the organization? Where do we want to focus? As well as what are some of our key strategies within the organization? Beneath that, we move down to a little bit darker color. Now we're into the actual business units. And each business line, each major area that owns assets, puts together a strategy. And we're building these as resources are available. And it talks about who they are, what they're going to do, how they're supporting the strategic alignment, what their risks are, what their main strategies are, et cetera, what their goals are. And then beneath that, we build specific strategies. And this is where, like right now, Generation is working on a gantry crane strategy. This is how we're going to take care of gantry cranes at Chelan PUD, knowing what we know of our risk tolerance, our appetite, and what our goals are. It'll have system strategies. So a system strategy might be a whole generating unit or a substation. It could have a class strategy, which is a flavor of an asset, a rotor, a battery, a breaker. Or there can be a site strategy, like Rock Island Powerhouse 1 might have a site strategy around them. So we know we need to build out these strategies across the organization. And finally, in our framework, is what we call the asset management plans. These are not documents. These are databases. This is all of our maintenance information, our resource information, our project schedules, our replacement plans, our risk information. It's a whole bevy of things that help us do what we're doing with the idea that everything we do aligns back up and we know how it relates to our strategic plan. So this is the commitment that we've put together, and you see Steve there and Steve's endorsement of it. There are copies on the back table if you're interested. And it starts at the top talking about why what we're trying to do with asset management. And then it includes a variety, 8 different principles here, such as using the total cost of ownership, using risk-based decision-making, implementing long-term systematic planning. And the overall goal here is to be able to balance that cost, risk, and performance in every decision we make and know that we're making it in a way that aligns with the strategic plan. So I'm going to start right now and give you a couple highlights of what we've been doing at the district-wide level, and then I'm going to bring others up to share what's been happening in the different business lines, and then we'll close with questions. So district-wide, we started out a year ago, March, and we brought a trainer over, an international trainer, an expert on asset management. It's interesting that Australia, New Zealand, and Europe are ahead of the United States in this practice because of regulatory requirements. They were required to do modern asset management to get funding, and so they tend to have a lead. So we had an individual who came over, and we arranged training for a variety of different people at Chelan. We didn't offer an invitation to our peers, since she was already here and there were no extra expenses, to join us for some of this training. And indeed, we were fortunate enough to have seven individuals from BPA, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the Bureau of Rec come and join us, which we got to get a little of their perspective and enrich the training at no cost, which was kind of fun. And it made some relationships, too, which was nice. After we got everybody on the fundamental concept of what is modern asset management, and we did that based on people's roles, so what accounting saw was slightly different than what the leadership team saw, etc., we then developed the governance that I shared with you, as well as the framework that I shared, the commitment, and we put together our first strategic asset management plan for the district, which gets refreshed annually. Next, we've conducted a significant amount of district-wide outreach, where we help reach out to people who might be impacted by any changes that would be occurring in how we do processes, methodologies, or even communicate. And we've developed a full internal internet site to enhance and help with this communication, so people have a place to go to see what we're up to. And, of course, we have our quarterly meetings. The first kind of effort that we did district-wide to try to work together was we, as a district-wide team, selected a methodology for doing criticality ranking. Well, this is really important because if you'll remember in that triangle, we talked about wanting to get to strategies for most things that we own, and there's a lot of them. So how do we decide what we want to work on first? And it's easier if we all go about this in the same methodology to decide what's most important. And so we did a pilot of a criticality ranking methodology. It wasn't perfect, but it was pretty good, and we were able to use it for what we want to do next. And then we established, we've got this established routine district-wide coordination with quarterly senior team meetings, monthly district-wide governance meetings, each of those different business unit meetings, as well as our quarterly stakeholder outreach meeting, and then a variety of different review committees and working groups so that we can keep that coordination and communication going. So with that, I'd like to invite John Yale, our hydro engineering manager, up to talk about some of the generation highlights.
So I'm John Yale. I'm the hydro plant engineering manager. And the first thing I'm going to say, other than being the beginning of the tag team, is everything I talk about here is work that Janelle did. I'm just giving you some variety of people looking at me. So, a couple of years ago, two of us got certified.
Hey John. I'm going to ask you, we've been listening to some of the tapes, and we're realizing that mic doesn't work very well for picking up on. So we're going to actually ask you to sit down and use the mic down there.
Well, and since we have your attention on how this mic really works, you have to hear yourself talk. That's really what it amounts to right now until we get a new mic. So anyone else that gets up here, please hear yourself talk today. Thank you.
Or we'll do a lot of jumping up and down. Anyway, two of us got certified in asset management by the Institute of Asset Management. The purpose there wasn't to put another certificate on the wall, but was to go through the training, and accompanied by an exam there for fun, but go through the training so we really understand what the international perspective is, so that we can bring that to the district rather than our perspective as being part of Chelan PUD. We are working on developing a generation-level asset management strategy, so that's looking across the generation fleet, all of its assets, trying to come up with a high-level strategy from which the specific equipment strategies like gantry cranes will draw up to. We've done a criticality ranking all the way through the powerhouses. So every system, every piece of equipment, every structure within a project, we went through and did criticality ranking on those, which created some very interesting surprises, things that you went, oh, well, duh, but we hadn't thought it or looked at things that way before. The purpose of that is really to help us prioritize. There's no use spending energy up front on something that's not very critical, neglecting things that are critical. So it's an important step there. We're working on the asset classes then falling beneath that. Along with this, of course, we have lots and lots of data, lots of systems, lots of information out there, and we're having to do a lot of cleanup on that. basically because we're changing the focus of how we're using some of our tools. We've worked hard on creating a peer outreach. We've helped found a task force regarding asset management specifically for hydro. It involves about 12 real committed, fully involved utilities drawing from a pool of a little over 80 now. And those are North American, Canadian, U.S., as well as a couple from Southern Hemisphere and several from Europe. So we're trying to get this group together to specifically look at how does hydro do this type of thing. And lastly, we're working on building a methodology for long-term planning around the units. As you're aware, we've had plenty of challenges lately due to aging of the assets, and we're trying to create ability to look at a long-term plan, understand the decisions that we make. So this is an example, and it's not really as scary as it looks. But the idea here is this is looking at each individual unit. And of course, as you're aware, each unit is made up of about 8 to 10 different key assets, any one of which will take that unit out of service, whether it's the generator, the turbine runner, the shaft, the governor. So these are kind of a combination. But the idea here is to be able to look across the fleet, understand our condition now, understand how our condition's going to change over time, and understand the results of interventions and actions that we take. The goal being not to have things in the very poor condition without understanding why we're there and making that a choice, and not spending too much money to make sure that we're always in the good and fair, but balancing the strategic objectives with the risks and the condition of the equipment. So this is a high-level plan. It's in development, and it's gradually getting stronger and stronger legs underneath it. So I will pass the chair and the mic over to Chad.
Good morning. Chad Rissman, Director of Distribution Asset Management. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about some of the highlights on the customer utility side. In addition to being a significant contributor to the overall district standards, we're also working on some of those business lines. If you go back to the pyramid concept, trying to make that connection between poles, wires, breakers, batteries, and the strategic plan, there's a gap in the middle. And that's really this developing a business line strategic plan. So that's something that we can accomplish, and we have many documents out there that attempt to do that. How do we do that in a measurable, traceable way so that we can use that information in there, incorporate risk, and improve our decision-making, and then monitor how well that connects up to our individual assets and our strategic plan? That's really what we want to focus in on doing, and making it as simple as being three parts to that, right? And those three parts have been mentioned before by Janelle, which is performance, risk, and costs. So using those three highlighted areas. So we've been working on the distribution business line strategy, trying to come up with that in a measurable way. We have that down to a final draft. It's just going to go through our distribution governance group. We've also started on the water and wastewater level asset management strategies, learning some of the lessons and taking some of the things that we figured out doing the distribution one on there. Conducted a criticality ranking, participated in the overall district-wide effort, and then applied that to the distribution-specific assets. Had a few things that we recognized were a little bit different out of that effort. A few of the assets that we wanted to tackle first, one of those being batteries. So now what we're doing is developing a battery asset similar to their gantry crane asset strategy that connects up to the business line strategy, which connects up to, in a measurable way, connects up to the district strategic plan. Improving the district-wide information model, there was a few references that Janelle made and others, and also the video that talked about data. We have a lot of data. The key is making that usable data and turn it into information and incorporating it in an efficient way into our decision-making. We've had running for quite a while this concept of a data warehouse. The version 2 of data warehouse is being worked on in partnership with IT. and being guided by several other folks to try to store asset management data in such a way that's accessible and we can connect it up to the work that we're doing in these strategic plans. Distribution group also had two certified employees on the in asset management. I received the certification. I was mentioned that about halfway through the class, I thought, man, this is really complex and confusing. And for some reason, a light bulb came on, and we realized quickly that, as Janelle mentioned, there's a lot of this asset management stuff the district is doing, but it's incorporating the risk and some other information into the decision making. So it's really an expansion of what we're already doing, and in many ways, a rebranding of what we're doing and then improving that. So that was my takeaway from that certification process. Networks next. So next to talk a little bit about highlights on the network side is Bob Shane.
Bob Shane, Director of Fiber and Telecom. Good morning, Commissioners. I will provide you a very high overview of what where we are in the asset management. Basically, we're leveraging the efforts and processes developed by the asset management team. We're taking that and we're applying that to both the fiber and the telecom portion of what we do in my particular department. We want to adapt the process as appropriate to fit our needs, moving away from what Janelle talked about, the traditional to the modern approach, but using more of a phased approach in getting there, particularly trying to be efficient with the staff availability. So we have, as most of us, limited staff, and so we need to work this into our program, if you will, the most efficiently. As part of that, we'll continue with engagement with the asset management team and learn from others. What we're trying to really do is, instead of recreate the wheel, John and Janelle, as they put stuff together, we're trying to take that and shrink it down to what might make sense for our particular assets and business lines without creating something from scratch. We're also seeking collaboration between business units with similar asset types and challenges. For example, the IT group and the control systems group, they have systems similar to ours in that they're networking pieces of equipment, and they have all the challenges that we have in our particular field. So how can we work together to see if we can't accomplish a common goal? Specifically for 2016, we're developing our priorities and overall framework and looking for gaps and optimizing our assets. Part of that is under our long-range technology planning initiatives, we're looking at total cost of life cycle management of our devices, our systems, and we have quite a few of them. We're looking at the technology, how it evolves from a risk perspective, meaning that there are technologies that may be phasing out and new technologies coming in. We want to make sure that we're on top of that to make sure that we get to the right solution at the right time. Part of that is also the end-of-life support of our products. Just because the system is no longer supported by the manufacturer doesn't mean it doesn't still meet our operational needs. And so we try to push that to the extent that we can without increasing our risks. We're particularly concerned about horizon technologies, that being new technologies that might be a barrier for us to be successful in the long run. There could be changes in technology that challenges what we do now in terms of our ability to deliver the products that we do in the most cost-effective way. Reliability is always a top thing for us. How can we make our system more reliable? Excuse me. We're also constantly looking at advanced solutions. And what I mean by that is our system is built one way based on a technology that may be a couple years old. As those products mature, there could be new solutions that we could apply without just taking the old one and upgrading. Maybe there's times to go ahead and cut your losses and devise a new solution, a new core network. We're looking at that constantly. The other driver for us is customer use. We want to look at their trends and expectations. A lot of that is bandwidth or speed driven. As you can imagine, as new applications become available on the networks over the internet, it pushes our system to be more responsive, both in capacity and speed. So we're always looking well ahead to see where that's coming from.
Bob, if I may ask a question on that, where does mobility fit into speed and other, I guess, desired qualities?
mobility in terms of the district's assets, in terms of like a telecom?
Customer, I've got my devices. How do I stay in tune with the network that we've developed and manage my personal assets? And what's our assurance to our customers that we're going to match what it is we're doing with the constant onslaught of changes in their mobile technology?
It's a great question, and it's a complicated answer.
Yeah.
I'm going to break up in two different areas. One, for the district's telecommunication systems, like our phone systems, for example, we have the overriding need for security for our conversations, our data, and stuff like that. So that will evolve as the business needs require. So we're not going to necessarily deploy it wholesale unless there's a business case to do that. And so part of our outreach and doing our replacement of our telecom systems, we're seeking that from our stakeholders. Is it something we really need? And if it is, we build a business case and we put the proper controls in there. So that part of it is being taken care of as we go through our replacement of our systems, specifically the phone switch, for example. On the broadband side, the fiber side, again, we're the infrastructure owner. We don't actually control what goes over the internet or that content. So providers would probably engage in their customers to understand what their needs are. And through that, we would develop with that stakeholder collaborative solution and come up with whatever the industry is pushing in that direction. Part of looking at the technologies, we're also looking to see where it is going in general. If mobility is something that's becoming a bigger, bigger issue, our manufacturers, our products will be moving in that direction as well, and we learn from that as we go forward. So there's a lot to be said there.
Yeah, and I guess my concern is, you know, a lot of the assets that we have to manage are pretty solid ongoing and have a much longer half-life than other parts of our organization. And so the rapidness of turnover in some areas is always going to present a challenge, whereas some others we have a little bit more time to think about what it is we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'm just kind of looking at this asset management in terms of what's our rapid response areas and what are our areas where we can be a little bit more deliberate, and how do we stay in tune with both of those?
Mm-hmm. It's a tough one. It's a tough balancing act. One of the things that we keep engaged with the service providers, we understand what the end customers are wanting, mm-hmm. in addition to us doing our own research and studying. Again, we rely heavily on our manufacturers as they develop their products. They're pretty sharp. They're looking to see where the industry is going. We're looking to basically make sure we're in alignment with what they're saying in terms of our local areas and service. It's something we haven't seen a lot of challenges in that area yet, just because bandwidth is just more of a need, mm-hmm. and everything else runs application-wise on top of that network. So if you have the bandwidth, you can really anticipate and be best prepared for whatever the advanced services or new services be on the system. What you don't want to do is overinvest and have much more speed than you need for obvious reasons, because you're throwing money away. So it's a catch-22, but we watch that pretty carefully.
Thank you.
Welcome. One key point I want to make, and Chad mentioned it briefly, is that through our normal routine work, we watch a lot of this stuff. I mean, we can't build this network and operate it without watching our system, how it's performing in terms of meeting the customer's expectations through collaboration with the service providers. We have a lot of electronic systems that monitor the performance of our system, so we can watch to see what the system's being stressed and anticipate where that growth might be, and more surgically go in there and upgrade portions of the network instead of all the network. It's much more cost effective. But at the same time, watching where the evolution is going so that we don't invest in one area just to know that in 3 years we're probably going to start all over on that area. So that's about it.
With that, we'll turn it over to Felicity Saberhagen for District Services Highlights.
Good morning. Felicity Saberhagen, Business Advisor, and I'm here to talk about District Services today. District Services has been impacted by modern asset management in a couple of different ways. One, we are really involved in the lifecycle delivery process. As Janelle mentioned earlier, that six-box model, we're in that circle that she pointed out. Engineering and project management has had to evolve how we do our project management. We do very well at the project component, but how we integrate with asset management has been a big change for us this year. So two things we put in place this year. One is we've begun assigning essentially a program manager for each of the assets that we support, for each of the areas that we have. So we have one single point of contact rather than just farming out projects to individual engineers or project managers as they come in. Secondly, we have also improved our turnover closeout process. As Janelle mentioned, if you think of the big triangle, down at the bottom is all of that data that's in there. All of that data has to come from projects or assets that are projects that engineering has started in a lot of ways. So we fill those operations and maintenance instructions, and those are part of what get filled into that data that gets used to develop our asset management programs. Additionally, district services is owner of some programs, it's all the ancillary stuff that you don't really think of as being direct customer focused, but all of the support mechanisms, which include parks, fleet, hatcheries, and our facilities programs. So we've done a couple of things this year to try and advance those and fit into the asset management program. As Janelle mentioned earlier, too, the governance piece that we have, that box that's been set up, we've established that within our own group now, too. So this next year will be similar to what Generation has and district and customer utilities have. District services will also have that available for this next year. That will also allow us to provide review the criteria that's being put forward, assess the risk associated with each of our assets, and help prioritize projects as a program rather than as individual projects. We've also been, as many of you are aware and discussed earlier today too, the strategic facilities plan is in place. That's one of the areas that we have that we don't have that strategic plan. And as Janelle mentioned, that's what we need to feed into all of that through asset management programs. So as we have that defined, we'll be able to then look at how are we going to implement that going forward. And our fleet program as well, we've been looking at standardizing that criteria. So we've done a benchmark study, been working with a consultant to determine how best to replace those so that we have the lowest cost of ownership associated with our fleet, which includes reviewing miles, hours, and age of the assets themselves. With that, I think that's probably about what I'd like to cover today. And I think transmission is next. Is that you, Chad?
Good morning. I'm Steve Wickle, the Transmission Engineering Manager. I'll be brief here this morning. So the Transmission Department for years has maintained a 20-year plan for our major transmission assets. It's updated annually to reflect the most recent conditions and priorities for the district. We've recently hired a planner in the Transmission Department with previous maintenance program experience, and I'm very excited to have him help us move our asset management program forward this year and next. We've selected our asset classes now for specific strategy development, and our next step is to begin collecting data on and for health index on our transformers and breakers, which are our first two asset classes that we'll be formalizing with our asset management program. And that was really all I had to say this morning. If there are any other questions. Yes.
Not so easy. Not so fast, I guess. So I know you guys have been collecting information on the transformers probably for a long time. But this is just kind of like a new effort that ties in with all the other asset management, correct?
Yes. So it's really just formalizing and putting all the information into one place, having it common amongst generation and distribution. So we're looking at the same things, putting risk into the equation so that we get an overall effective life of the transformer so that we can go across business lines and prioritize which transformers might need replacement or correction.
Prioritize them, yeah.
Yes.
Good. So one more question, and this I should know, but I don't. I'm driving down today. The Winesap substation, I'm way behind, is now empty. There's nothing there. What was there? When did that get moved? Probably a long time ago.
My memory maybe is just as bad, but I don't recall. But it was not too long after we made improvements, the South Shore substation, Chad, in 2008. 2008, South Shore Substation, we connected up INIA and South Shore Substation at that time. WineSap was not used anymore.
So it'll sit there, just a concrete pad and fence until?
Until we think of another use or something, an opportunity comes up.
Is it a solid concrete? Just
no, there's a couple of little pads in there where really? Structures sat on.
I was just thinking it would be great if it were. It'd be great for bumper bikes. I don't know if you know what bumper bikes is, but you know, a big confined area on concrete is perfect for that. Anyway, okay, I'm behind. I knew it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So what will the changes be for the board? Well, as you see, we're trying to work on consistency. We're all trying to use the same framework, the pyramid, and we're all trying to move through it in a similar way. So that'll become a more common way of justifying how we want to do replacement projects, and everything should be coming from a standardized strategy over time. So there'll be risk included, performance included, and the overall value will be included. These long-term plans that have come forward over the years, we've always had them, but they're getting stronger and stronger in terms of including more standardized condition information and having more risk information behind them. So we can understand if we were to modify them, what that might mean. You know, if we change the protocol for financial reasons, resource reasons, something breaks we're not expecting, what have you, what's that mean in a common way? And risk becomes a very, very central element of all of the recommendations and decision making. It's not deciding to plan to replace something at the end of its engineering life. Instead, it's saying, based on risk, when's the most cost beneficial time to replace it for our customer owners based on who we are and what we're trying to do? A lot of that can be based on reliability. And again, as I mentioned before, is just this new language, this conciseness, this clearness, repeatability, standardization, all trying to do things the same way and be very efficient at coming together and bringing that decision-making, strategy, risk and review, people and culture, and the data parts of it to that life cycle delivery. So with that, we would welcome any questions.
Commissioners?
Can I take a second and just add something I think is important here? I know that for a lot of folks, this can sound like a lot of process, and process is hard to understand where the value is created. But there are two really important things that I think are happening here. First is creating systems thinking. So it's not that the district didn't worry about its assets in the past, but the question right. really is, how does the value of this asset impact the value of our other assets? How do they work together? And how do we think of that in the context of the things that we do, creating revenue and markets that are moving up and down, reliability issues that we may be addressing, compliance issues that we may have? How do we think about that in terms of the risk associated with those elements that where we're trying to create value in those three fundamental areas of revenue, reliability, and compliance? So there are two things in addition to what's been mentioned here that are critical in order for us to succeed at this effort. The first is human intelligence. You can see that folks have been using their individual development plans to go off and develop skills and think more in a systems perspective. So it is critical to think about the fact that in order to make this work, if you're going to do systems thinking, you have to bring people up from their current thinking about I'm managing an asset to I'm managing an asset in a context of a system. And so we have to be successful with IDPs in order to make that happen. And second, we have to create a business intelligence system. So there's a lot of data that gets collected here. And currently, a lot of that has been managed in people's heads. So we have really smart people who keep things in their heads and managed in that way. And that's both a problem in terms of making sure that we really understand all of the pieces, but it's also a succession planning problem. So when you create a business intelligence system that allows you to collect all this data and be able to see it, you're able to make connections between different pieces of the system, and you're able to transfer knowledge more quickly when you reach that point of succession planning. So big effort that ultimately I believe very strongly will create long-term value. It reinforces our reinvesting in the assets, but making sure that we don't think of them as individual assets. Mm-hmm. We're thinking about reinvesting in assets in order to create value for our customers.
Great job, Janelle.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, everybody.
Yeah. Chad?
Oh, I just wanted to mention, and this goes along with what Steve was just talking about, Janelle's been wearing two hats through this whole effort. One is building all the asset management into generation hydro side of things, but she's also been playing the leadership role and bringing all of the different people together. It's amazingly different between hydro, transmission, distribution, parks, facilities, fleet. Everybody's focused in on performance, cost, and risk, but the components of that are completely different. And Janelle's ability to break down the concepts of asset management, bring us all together and start discussing things and building things in a common way, I very much appreciate. So thank you, Janelle, for that.
Okay. If there are no further questions, I have one. There's obviously, you know, from your earlier statements, a lexicon and specific vocabulary that goes with this whole process. And I applaud you for unifying that linguistic part of it, because without that, we're still lost. So the question, though, is how do we do that and not create separation? It's great that staff would have a common language. So what's the plan to educate, as an example, the governing board in terms of a common vocabulary so that when you're reporting to us, there's a clear understanding of what you're doing? And then I think that the greatest concern I have is how do we then bring our public along? And all of us have been frustrated by attending a opportunity with our physician to have a condition explained to us in medical terminology, and you walk out the door and you have no idea what the hell they just said. And so how do we avoid the what I would call the medical vocabulary in relationship to our customers so that they understand and appreciate the value that this process has created? Is that a fair question?
I think it's a fabulous question, and actually we talked about it at pretty good length in pre-agenda, and one of the things that we would offer is within the board, you're all welcome to attend the quarterly update meetings that we do, because those are for anyone internal to the district, but there may be opportunities to come back and do portions of presentations where it makes sense and we have time available to do education as we go. One of the basic tenets of asset management is this concept called a whole life cost model. And it literally is a chart that shows the optimum financial time to replace something. It's not the world's simplest concept. It's not the world's most complex either, but we decided not to introduce it here today because it kind of warrants its own small discussion. So this is a wonderful opportunity to talk about what different forums we may want to use and what we think is appropriate in terms of what we share and how we share it and how we educate and how frequently and with whom. So I think that is a terrific point, and it's something we definitely need to explore as a team, and any ideas would be really welcome.
Yeah, I just don't want us to become so specialized that we lose our ability to communicate effectively with the people who own it.
And I think part of the goal here is to make sure that it's actually simpler. That, you know, one group doesn't call something a modernization and somebody else right. calls something a refurbishment. Or my favorite example is we're calling our governor electronic replacements. We're calling them one thing at Rock Island and another thing at Rocky Reach. Mm-hmm. So laying out those standards within our staff actually means that when things come to you and then go to the public, we're all calling a widget, not a widget and a wadget. Yeah. So I think some of that is self-healing, but I do think there's also some opportunity.
Yeah. And make sure you understand that as commissioners, we have to take everything that you're doing and a common vocabulary that you're developing and be able to deliver it inside of a minute at an aisle in Albertsons.
Exactly. Football game, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a good challenge for us. I think this is a starting point for that.
Yeah.
It's an opportunity to give you some sense of where this work is going and let you cogitate on it and give us some thoughts back about what more you'd like to hear about.
Yeah. And by asking a question, I do not want to create any impression that I have any doubt about this process. It's one that is exciting. I'm watching some other local public institutions create greater and greater distance between people who are making the decisions and the people who are responsible for carrying them out, and almost to the exclusion of the people who end up at the bottom end of the customers. And I'm just watching that dissidence occur and just completely dismayed by it. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a great opportunity for us to do what it is we do and do it well. We just need to make sure that the people who actually own the organization get the chance to be with us in that whole process and understand what it is we're doing and have that inclusive vocabulary.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Big priority.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bergeron, anything?
I've just been sitting here listening very attentively. I just want to say I really do appreciate the presentation. It's very well done. I really do like the disciplined approach moving forward. I think it's critical when we look out 10 years into the future as a strategic plan. We need to have this kind of investment management. It's just a critical part of the whole plan. So I think they did a great job. I see one thing that seems to me that jumps out, that we're talking about managing this data, and there's going to be a tremendous amount of data, and I think that's going to be a challenge moving forward, how we're going to use that data and how we're going to make sense out of all of that. So anyway, I'm about done. I'm at my limit here for talking. So anyway, good job. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Anything else?
I'd like to just chime in and say that this process of risk management brings me great comfort that we're moving in this direction. I understand that it will be quite complex and perhaps a departure from how we have communicated and dealt with risk items in the past. But I think properly implemented, which I have every reason to believe that it will be, will bring greater assurity to the assets that we are responsible for the community well into the future. So I'm pleased at your presentation today and look forward to hearing more.
Yeah. And a personal comment or compliment to you, Janelle, is a great presentation without teleprompter and limited use of notes, which indicates to me that there's been a complete immersion in this whole process and you're living it. So thank you very much.
We are living it. Thank you.
Ann?
You know, I participated in the behavior styles workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to admit I ended up coming out as a conductor. And so I have some work to do. And so one of my goals is to talk less and listen more. And the other thing is think clearly before I speak. So I'm trying really hard to do that. So. Great job.
Anything else? Anyone else? Thank you. And to all those who are concerned and are involved in this, I can, appreciate it very much, and we'll be better. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Suncrest Fire?
Yeah, we want to bring you up to
date. Do you have some other place you want to go?
No, actually, that's perfect. We want to bring you up to date on Suncrest Fire, and I think Steve Wickle, I believe, is going to come up and help lead this conversation for us.
Gosh, we don't see him very often now today. We're just like repetitive and redundant.
But we have a lot of folks who've been involved in this, and so we also want to welcome Tim Pettit to the table, who we don't get to see very often because he's in the field so much and doing a great job. So Steve and Tim will tell us about this, and I think we'll hear a little bit about the fiber component as well.
Sure. Yep. All right, good morning. Steve Wickle, Transmission Engineering Manager. I'll give a brief update of where I'm at with fire, and Tim will, I guess, provide what he knows what I didn't cover. So the fire was reported to system operations on Saturday afternoon, August 27th. We removed two transmission lines from service shortly thereafter at the request of the first responders on scene. This resulted in approximately 3,700 customers being without power in the Lake Wenatchee Plain and Coles Corner area. The line crews coordinated with the incident commander right away, allowed access to get in to not only assess the burning structures and the area of the fire, but also to get out ahead of the fire and do what they can to mitigate should the fire go through the transmission structures to hopefully have them not catch on fire. The lines were restored the following Tuesday, August 30th, around 5:30 p.m. There were a total of five structures on the two transmission lines that needed to be replaced. We've currently replaced four of those structures. One more is going to be replaced as soon as good access is cleared out to get to the structure. Let's see. So the estimated cost of repairs is approximately $175,000. It's tough to know right at the moment on that because that was overtime and kind of in an emergency status. So currently, as I said, all lines are in service now. There is one structure left to replace. The fires burned very hot, burning the tree roots and the tree canopies. And these trees are now subject to blow down. There's approximately 50 trees that we want to cut down now. The vegetation program manager has worked with the landowner, Tom McDevitt, to coordinate the tree removal, and that is scheduled to begin on September 12th. And that's what I have.
Good morning, everybody. Tim Pettit, operations manager for the distribution department. To come up here after all that asset management stuff is a little difficult, but I believe all the way down to the nuts on the bolts that are tightened up, that's where asset management begins. And Mr. Bowles spoke of having the luxury of having time sometimes to sit down and come up with a plan and walk through it, but unfortunately, we're getting real good at having to make these calls on the run. The last 4 years have been quite a challenge. This first picture that you'll see here, you'll actually notice the transmission lines up in the upper left-hand corner there, which is where the fire started, was up in that vicinity. And we've also gotten to build relationships with the fire investigators this year on a number of occasions. But it's actually been a great relationship-building experience, the openness, the transparency of them with us. We have been very open and transparent with those gentlemen. I have another call to make today, actually, on the fire that occurred this weekend on Horse Lake. But with that being said, let's see here. After the fire, it was actually Cody Murdoch seeing the fire from his home start, and that's where this picture came from. So he initiated the call to system ops to get those lines de-energized. There again, just for safety of not only the lines, but personnel and everybody that was in the area. We initiated with a couple of switchmen on site. We really try to manage personnel close in these situations with as many fire personnel that's out there. You have to be careful of who you have out there, the amount of equipment, everything that's going on. We brought one crew on site, and as Steve mentioned, that was the crew. We monitored the situation. We were out looking at the poles. We actually came across a number of poles that were on fire, got permission to go in and get the poles, the fires put out, because the last thing we want is our system laying on the ground. We actually, every night, this system was in a place where it could have been used had there been an emergency in place. So they did a fantastic job with that. I'm just going to walk through a few pictures here that show kind of what we deal with on a day-to-day basis, actually. These are the trucks, D5 Cat in front, being pulled up very steep grades, very steep conditions that are going throughout. The guys just do a fantastic job. Over the last 4 years, 5 years, the relationships we've built with fire personnel, sheriff's department, emergency management personnel, it's been fantastic. So this one here, I'm not quite sure how we... So what we've done in the distribution department is there's been a lot of discussion over pre-task plans, job site analysis. There's a number of different terms for it. We've went to voice recordings. And I just kind of like to play this. This is something that our crews do in the field for every job that we pull up on.
From Canyon to Fox Canyon. Let me back this up. Today is August 29th. Jesse Nick. Josh Schaefer.
Chad Cottrell.
Andy Rice.
Charles Miller.
And we're replacing two structures, a pole on each structure on the fire that burned. We're working on the McKinsey Beverly 32/5 and the LT1 1/6. We're going to have a clearance on both lines from Anderson Canyon to Fox Canyon. Have grounds on them. It's going to be a lot of fire traffic, steep hills, dusty, hot,
smoke,
smoky. and lunch. And lunch. We're going to try to get lunch in there. Drink lots of water.
And dinner.
And yeah, any hazards, anybody, watch out for traffic, other cars, and same hazards as normal. Well, that's it. Talk about it later if something changes.
Tim, can I just, for the board's benefit, say that this is part of the effort where we've gone to pre-task planning to get folks to think about the risks associated with safety in advance of the actual work that's being done. And as Tim has suggested, actually gone to pre-recording that so we can actually go back and check later and see, okay, what is it that we understood were the risks in that particular moment. Really feel like it's a good, strong advancement in terms of improving the safety record, and Tim's been a great leader on this.
Thanks, Steve. And what we try to do with that, we actually bring the foreman in and we talk about these, but if you'll notice in that very, very short stint, you notice that the camaraderie of the group, you notice that the attitudes were good, they identified their opens, that the grounds were on the line, they were in steep area. They don't go into the specifics. They're professionals. They deal with this every day. And so if you tried to get into the tensions that are on the lines, we need to do this, it's you would be there all day. But what you can pick out of these is they identify the very important things, that the line's de-energized, where the opens are, the grounds are on, we're safe to go to work. Be careful of surrounding people. This is a shot of where they were working, and you can see the transmission poles on the other side. We're working on the poles over here. So not only are they working with tremendous tensions on those lines, but the weight when you're unclipping those, trying to reset the new poles, it's amazing. That's probably close to, it's over a third of a mile of line that they have going. This is some repair work being done close to the homes. This is some of the old poles being loaded, coming out from the transmission structures replaced. Fiber also, I think one of the real benefits, if you can take that from this situation, was emergency management was getting no feedback from Verizon or anyone, and all the communications were down. And it was really beneficial. I actually ended up calling Mike, having communications a number of times, sitting there with emergency management, and to be able to give them an idea of what the issues were and the time frames that were coming up, they were extremely appreciative just to have the information.
Bob Shane, Fiber and Telecom. I was coming into Leavenworth from Seattle that afternoon. As I got closer to Leavenworth, my phone started to go nuts with phone calls and text messages. And then within 5 minutes, when I come around the bend, I see plumes of smoke. And of course, my words to my wife were, not quite, oh darn, but we got problems here. So I pulled off the road and started making some phone calls. Overall, we really survived really, really good on this. Majority of our fiber in Chelan County is overhead. There's portions of it that are direct barrier underground. This portion actually was underground. Unfortunately, the vault where these fibers come into is no longer there. So it's a difficult picture to really make out, but there should be a fiberglass green vault sitting there. It's completely gone. There's no evidence that anything was there, and the little pieces of wood are really the fiber, that the resulting fiber. So you see, it got so hot that it actually melted the dirt. That's dirt back there. That's not, those aren't clay bricks. That's dirt. The little lines or ridge lines in the vault that were there that are now gone. So it completely destroyed that vault and everything in there. But the good thing was we had vaults on adjacent sides of that. So we had slack storage that were able to pull from those and bring it back into this location and resplice. So we saved quite a bit of time in having that slack storage that's part of our normal design process. There are four circuits. It's a single cable, four circuits that were damaged, and happened to be four major cellular companies that went down all at the same time. Be about, service disruption was about 19 hours, 5 minutes, and 56 seconds. We record this information. We know how long it went down and when it went back up. We had two crews, total time of about 9 hours for the restoration. Having the fiber in both adjacent vaults probably shaved a good 4 hours off of that process. We did spend 5 hours the night before some general recon. Our crews are very concerned about safety, but they're also trying to anticipate what the work might be to get that restored. So the minute it went down, we were rolling to understand what was going on, keeping with working with SysOps and the distribution guys to make sure where the fires were. So we had a good shot that evening to take an assessment. And next thing, Saturday morning at 7 o'clock, we rolled and were able to get the system up by 1 o'clock that afternoon. So that's about it.
I just would like to make one other comment, Steve, as you mentioned with the pre-task plans and things. And safety, our ability to be able to go out there and work with the emergency management system, the sheriffs, all of that starts with relationships. And we have built some fantastic relationships. And when you mention safety, the line department, let alone in a single crew shop, which there's many of them in our industry, when we're running 7 crews, we're at 900 days without a lost time incident. And that's not from luck. The guys do a fantastic job. We've been through multiple events. But always keep in mind, if there is something that occurs, if you have no accidents, doesn't necessarily mean you're working safe. And if you have accidents, doesn't necessarily mean you're working unsafe. We rely on mechanical equipment, electrical equipment, hydraulic equipment. And at any time, those fails can create an accident. But at this point in time, for the distribution group to be out there working over 900 days without a lost time accident is exceptionally impressive. And I'm really proud of those guys.
Maybe we just take a second if Ron Franklin would come up and talk about the safety element of the Suncrest fire as well.
Director of Safety, Ron Franklin. Tim's touched on some critical points there, and this kind of ties us back. If you remember earlier, we had a safety minute for Bill Kaminsky on awareness in your situation. And that's really when we get into those and we have to respond. Yeah, we got a lot of work to do, but it doesn't mean you don't still do your diligence. You don't still plan the workout. And that's part of that pre-task planning they do. And critical point of that, too, is you talk about this, but you also have to have everybody's engagement. You can't have somebody not engaged in that process, because if you have somebody who's not, that's putting the whole crew at risk. And as you can tell by the audio there, they have that. I think we said there's 3 pretty intense days up there. And with all that work, and you saw the terrain we're in, and there's also some interaction with other agencies. I mean, we're not working on an island there. We've got other people we interact with. But we did that work and that amount of time and all that with no property damage or equipment damage or an injury. And it's not something you want to sit there and say, let's get really, you know, we're going to get good at this by practice. And unfortunately, we get good at this because this is what we do. If you look back at the fires of last year, you look at the ice storms we had at Lake Wenatchee. I point back to those also. We had no real injuries on those. We had one strained shoulder up at that ice storm we had up there. And if you were up in that area when they were working, it was a war zone up there. And it really does attribute back to, as Tim talks about, the professionalism of the crew and then giving them the tools and the knowledge and the ability to be successful and respond as they know how. So, again, we had some close moments there where we had to respond and take care of some of our customer owners, but we didn't sacrifice safety or put anybody health at risk other than they're normally knowing what they know how to do. So I think that's the real success story in my estimation. Thank you.
Comments, questions? Compliments, Steve, Tim, Bob, Ron, thanks. Something well done again. Safety first, customers in that same vein. Nice job. All right.
I'd like to just chime in here and build on what you just said in terms of some of the really hairy situations that the district has found itself in, weather-wise, wildfire-wise. And one of the things that there's been one commonality that I've noticed as I get my calls on my phone, and there's tremendous crew that gets involved across the entire district. But I would like to make mention that if the Chelan PUD has a wildcatter who's kind of always in the deep of it, I keep hearing Tim Pettit's name.
So, Tim, I don't know when you get to sleep, because a lot of these occur at night, kind of like childbirth, but I personally want to say thank you for kind of always being in the lead on these things, and I certainly appreciate it.
Well said. With that, if there's nothing else on the agenda at this point, we'll take a recess until we reconvene at 1 o'clock, and we'll start with our consent agenda, go to manager items, and then proceed through the rest of the agenda after that. That being said, recess till 1. Good afternoon, and welcome to the business session of Chelan County Public Utility District. The date is September 6th, 2016. The time is 1:01, and we have a quorum of commissioners, two of us here, one on the phone, and a third one will be returning shortly, but enough to go ahead and continue our business session. And so we have a number of things in front of us for this afternoon. And what we're also going to try and do is be cognizant of the request for us to lean closely into our microphones so that the recordings will be clear for those people who are listening to that recording at a later time or date. And with that being said, if you have a cell phone that's not in an off position or in a position that's going to attract attention to itself, would you please take care of that business for us? That being said, let's go ahead and move into Mr. Bergeron. Let me check, make sure you're online and ready to go.
I'm here and ready to go.
All right, thank you very much. Let's go ahead and take a look at the consent agenda. And commissioners, what's your pleasure?
I move that we approve the consent agenda.
I'll second it.
Been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda as amended in this morning's meeting. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of approving the consent agenda signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion is carried. And then for this afternoon session, we're going to start out with item number 12 currently. Our manager's items.
Okay, so we have a few things going on in the community that we wanted to bring up. And so I'm looking for a little help here. It's not here. Well, okay, so we have the videos, right? So we're going to show the videos on trail etiquette.
Yes, and Suzanne was going to do that.
Yeah, we're going to do it with her.
Okay. So.
And while we're waiting to get started, to the members of staff and public, we encourage your participation. And if you choose to do so, please make your ideas known through the microphone that's presented, and state your name and your address for our listening audience.
I'm that guy on the loop trail who likes to ride his bike really fast. It can get pretty crowded out here. It's the time to step it up. I'd say the spandex shaves at least 15 seconds off my loop time. And this is my Olympics. I mean, it's not like I'm going for the Olympics, but who knows?
Don't be that guy. Observe speed limits, especially in congested areas of the loop trail. A message from your Chelan PUD.
Shall we go in?
Please. Mm-hmm.
I'm that lady on the loop trail who uses a really long dog leash. The leash is pink. It's not hard to see. People can just walk or ride around it. Sometimes Brutus tells me he doesn't want to be on a leash, so I let him go wherever he wants.
Hey, do you mind? I'm allergic.
His favorite place to go is on the trail, but I don't like to pick up his little presents.
Don't be that lady. Please keep your dog on a leash. A short leash. A message from your Chelan PUD.
I'm that guy on the loop trail that doesn't like to warn people when I'm passing. I come here to get away. Not shout, on your left. Sometimes I forget what to say.
No, thank you. Oh, on your left.
Baby. Sometimes I use my warning whistle. Sometimes I like to find someone on the trail and draft behind them. saves me energy.
Don't be that guy. Warn people before you pass them on the trail. A message from your Chelan PUD.
Thank you.
There we go.
So do we have someone who's going to cover the trail issues? Okay.
So, good afternoon, commissioners. I'm Kimberly Craig, Public Information Officer, and with me today is the winner of our Connected Newsletter survey drawing. Tanya Davalos from Leavenworth was kind enough to fill out the survey, and she was one of 239 respondents that were entered in our drawing for the Kindle Fire 8. And Commissioner Bowles, would you like to present the Kindle to her?
I would like to do that, and my apologies for getting the cart before the horse and changing our agenda, having already committed to Kimberly that we would start with you right following lunch, and sorry to make you wait.
Oh, it's fine.
Yeah. You know, it's great that you chose to participate in our survey. It's going to give us a clear idea, you and the others who participated, to make our Connect newsletter even better. So we appreciate that, and your good deed should be rewarded. And so with that, we have here, and Kimberly, help me with the, it is a Kindle.
It is a Kindle HD 8 Fire.
Right. So I got the Kindle part. I'm glad you completed that for me. So on the behalf of the commission,
our express appreciation for all of you. So very much. That's great. We're going to take a quick picture. Okay.
And where would you like us to do that?
And then I will.
Let's turn the, yeah, turn the background. We'll take pictures of that.
There we go. Perfect. You've done this before, haven't you? Well, and as I told Tanya, it was so nice to have you. Just the demographic I was hoping to hear from. So that was
perfect. It's so wonderful that it worked out and the survey was so easy to flow through. So
Thank you.
Thank you. Kim, would you like to say something about the video?
I would. That's great. Can I ask Louise to escort them out?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you guys for your time.
Thank you. Look at that, you know, Randy's in Kyrgyzstan, Karnan's home ill, I'm running the meeting, and it just disintegrates. It's like dead time on the microphones, I'm telling you. The dog's world.
All right. Kim is coming back to join us so she can give us a little background on the videos.
Yeah. I'm suffering through dead air, so help me here.
Good afternoon. Again, Commissioners Kimberly Craig and Communications. So we are helping our park friends. The great thing about Chelan PUD Parks and the Apple Capital Loop Trail is that they're very popular. That also means that occasionally we have a few conflicts on the trail, and so that we wanted to take a humorous approach to reminding folks to be on the lookout for courtesy and to think about other folks on the trail when they're walking, running, rollerblading, or even if they're stopping. One of my favorites is when they stop to chat, and we love people to stop and chat and take pictures on the trail, just a reminder to step off them. The videos were produced by North 40, who's done quite a bit of other work for Chelan PUD, and we will be rolling them out starting even in the theaters, in the trailers that you see in front of movies. We're considering some local cable TV advertising and then social media as well. Do you have any questions?
Can you tell our audience where those videos will be seen?
They'll likely see them there on if they go to either the Gateway or the Liberty Theater. They'll be shown before movies. They'll have a chance to see them on Chelan PUD's YouTube channel. So if you go to YouTube and search Chelan PUD, they'll be there prominently. And then we're considering some local cable TV stations and working with our friends at Localtel and NCW Life Channel to place those.
They're wonderfully done.
They are. George and I went for a bike ride on Sunday, and I think I saw all three of those people.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kimberly. Those are well done.
Kim, I think we're going to ask you to stay and just speak about the community events as well.
Okay. Great.
I understand the feeling.
I appreciate your patience. I will say that there will not be a test later, but we are moving into fall, which is a prime time for engagement with our customers. So I'm going to mention a few. You don't have to take notes. I'll work with Sheila to make sure that they're all on your schedule. But it's a pretty big list this week as we get busy. So particularly this week, we're having the info cruise on Lake Chelan on Thursday. All the slots are filled now, but we were thrilled that that was happening. PUD representatives from customer accounting and from other areas, parks, will be at the Fiesta Mexicanas at Lincoln Park Friday and Saturday. On Saturday, September 10th, is the Senior Damboree, and as we like to say, don't let the kids have all the fun. So that's a celebration of adults 55 and older. Lots of friendly competition, square dancing, music, and do bring the grandkids. There'll be lots of activities for all ages. The next week, September 15th, Mike Coleman will be speaking on a panel talking about the benefits of broadband for business. That's part of a 3-workshop series that we're helping produce with GWADA. September 17th, Saturday, it's the Wenatchee River Salmon Festival at the Leavenworth National Fish Hatchery. And then our favorite time of year, what time of year is it? Public Power Week, October 2nd through the 8th. We'll be starting on following your board meeting on October 3rd. We'll give you a little heads up. We're going to have the unveiling ceremony for the first two of the electrical vehicle charging stations that are being installed under the public power benefit. There'll be other events through the week, and then we'll wrap it up with a big public outreach at Pybus Market on October 8th. And then just two more for the Visitor Center. They're doing behind-the-scenes tours at that beautiful Lake Chelan powerhouse at Chelan Falls. They're doing that on Saturday, October 22nd and 29th. And then the Visitor Center is wrapping up their season with the Fall Roundup 1 to 4 on Sunday, October 30th. So as I said, don't worry, there won't be a test, and we will make sure that we get these events on your calendar. Do you have any questions?
Nope. Good events. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to add one item under manager's items. So next week, next Thursday, I'll be in Seattle to speak to the Washington State Academy of Sciences, which is the state version of the National Academy of Sciences. There's a gentleman by the name of Anyan Bose, who is one of the premier power engineers in the country. He's been at Washington State for many years, and he's putting on an event for the Academy of Sciences on the Columbia River. I'll be a keynote speaker at that event, and because of Anyan's tenure in the industry, there's a pretty good array of folks from across the industry and the tribes and others that are going to be speaking at that particular conference. I'll be going on from there to New York for the LPPC CEO meeting, one of the 3 meetings a year that occurs there. So we'll be out the 18th and 19th, and because the next board meeting, we will be initiating the budget process for 2017. I do have a request in to you that we move the board meeting on the 19th to the 20th. As I understand, all of our commissioners are available to meet on the 20th, except for those who are going to be out of town anyway. Well, it would have been out on the 19th, as Gary was nodding his head, is reminding me. So we've got a couple of things that's going to keep me out of town for about 5 days or so.
Good.
Yep. And I think that's it.
Is that it for manager's items?
Yes, that's it.
We have a quorum, so my suggestion is let's just proceed with the resolutions and continue on with the agenda as published. So with that, Mr. Wright, Resolution 10, please.
Resolution rejecting the bid of Farmers Electric, LLC of Othello, Washington, accepting the bid of Colvico Incorporated of Spokane, Washington, bid number 16-37 for Wenatchee Confluence State Park 50-amp upgrades. Court Hill is going to present today.
Good afternoon. My name is Court Hill, and I'm a project manager here at the district. And joining me
is Christy Van Wagner. I'm a contract specialist.
Commissioners may recall that over the last several years, the district has completed 50-amp upgrades at several of our parks, namely Lincoln Rock State Park, Daroga State Park, Eniat Park, and BB Bridge Park. Wenatchee Confluence State Park is the last remaining park where these upgrades are needed. In 2015, Washington State Parks requested and received funding in their capital budget to conduct the 50-amp upgrades at Confluence. State Parks subsequently entered into a cost reimbursement agreement with the district for the district to oversee this project. We recently completed design and opened bids for the work. 7 bids were received. Those bids are tabulated as an attachment to the resolution. The bid by Farmers Electric 2 LLC of Othello did not meet the minimum requirements specified in the contract documents. Farmers did not provide required bidders data, including experience information, references, and resumes. And this bid should be rejected as non-responsive. District staff has determined that the bid of Colvico Incorporated of Spokane, Washington, in the amount of $398,776, excluding sales tax, is the lowest responsive and best bid in compliance with the plans and specifications for the bid. And this bid does meet all the statutory requirements. Rejection of the apparent low bid dollar bid is a requirement of commission and action of the commission. We're recommending that that we do award to Colvico. I would also like to add that we have shared the bid documents with State Parks, and State Parks, who is funding this project, is fully supportive of this recommendation to award to Colvico.
Kurt, would you take a moment and just describe what the benefit is of this work that's going to be done?
Okay. So the current state of our RV pedestals at the park at Wenatchee Confluence Park is that they're 30 amps, and the in recent years the RVs have increased in size and electrical demand, and so that creates a problem when the demand exceeds the capacity. And so for safety reasons and for to be good responsive to the customers, the district has made these upgrades at several of our parks, and State Parks in turn felt like it was high enough in their priority list to request funding from the state to do the project. So not only is it viewed by district staff as being really important, it's also very important to State Parks. And that's the feedback that they receive from users there in the park. These 50-amp upgrades are really important to the users.
Mr. Bergeron, any questions?
No, I don't have any questions. That's fine.
Thank you. Mr. Arsenault?
I am a little unfamiliar with how the bidding process unfolds. In this particular instance, Farmers Electric was quite a bit lower than the second bidder. And it appears that what they had not done is provided a listing of their experience, references, and resumes. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. Because it's so much cheaper, is it normal to maybe go back and say you forgot to do this? Or is in the bidding process, maybe you can just help to educate me on how that works.
Sure, Commissioner Eric Walquist, General Counsel. So the alternative that the staff is faced with at that point in time is to cancel the bid and rebid. So a bid is non-responsive if it does not provide all of the required documentation and information, fill in all of the blanks in a fashion. This is the, we asked you to build us a red house, and you promised to build us a red house, and you've proven that. So we don't have the ability to go on to go back after the fact, absent extremely extraordinary circumstances, and ask for supplementation of information in that regard. We're faced with the option of rejecting all of the bids or canceling the bid or coming through this process to the commission and asking for an award to the next apparent low bidder. Doing the opposite would give rise to the potential for bid protest by the next lowest bidder who was indeed responsive. So we are very constrained by the procurement processes here at the district. And I'm happy to take as much time anytime you're available to walk through those processes.
Thank you. I would appreciate that. I am always amazed at the cost of things. And I think Eric, you and I had a few seconds just to chat about the cost of adding 50 amps. And perhaps we can sit down and talk about all that is involved. But by my back-of-the-napkin calculations, it's just shy of $8,000 per campsite to bring 50 amps in. And that just seems like an awful lot of money. So
we can sit do down. One last thing and say that at the beginning of every year, we do four contract procedure trainings. They're about 4.5 hours. I do them, and you're welcome to.
Perfect. Sign me up. I'll be there. Thank you.
And I think if this is correct, Court, that there was consultation with Washington State Parks about this decision as well in terms of rejecting the low bidder. That
we're yes.
On their behalf here. And so maybe you could just take a second to describe how that process worked.
Yes, where State Parks fully funded this project, we wanted to keep them fully informed on the results of the bid, so we did share the bid documents with them, and they concurred with our recommendation to reject the low bid and to award to Colvaco. So they are in full agreement.
We have a separate reimbursement agreement with the state for this.
And I might also add your question about the cost. Washington State Parks does have their own design criteria they use for these projects. It's based on 30 or 40 years of experience, and it's a little above and beyond what the code requires. And that does impact the cost, though.
So. Yeah. Well, thank you. As a camper, I certainly appreciate 50 amps. So I understand the value of 50 amps. It's a big price tag at all.
It is. Yeah.
You know, I have a question, and I don't want it to appear misguided, but it's just a curiosity. Our estimated cost of this work is $740,000. The closest bid is $623,000. That's a sizable gap, but then you go down to the organization that we're going to award the bid for if it receives a favorable vote, and that's about $340,000 less than what our estimates were. So how do we end up with a bid that is approximately half of what our estimated engineering, services provided for us?
That's a very good question. It's very difficult for us to know where the bids are going to fall. And we do our best to estimate based on the most recent projects that we've done. And we have done several in the last few years, as State Parks has. And so our estimate was based on recent work. And sometimes the bid climate and conditions are just, it's hard to predict. So, yeah.
So, Commissioner, I would say that State Parks had a similar estimate issue because the original reimbursement agreement was for the full boat.
Yeah. No, I mean, I used to do concrete contracting. I remember walking out with the lowest bid one time, and it was about a quarter of what anybody else's was. And you have that, just that pit in your stomach that, what did they know that I didn't? But it just kind of, it's just interesting that it could be that wide of a gap. And it's not that I'm unhappy with it. I'm very happy with it, in fact. But it's just curious.
Yeah. On occasion, we have some unusual bids that come in, and I would have to agree that this is one of the more unusual.
Yeah. So any other thoughts, questions? And we're on resolution. Yeah. Commissioner Congdon. What are the desire of the commission, please, regarding this bid?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve resolution number 10, accepting the bid of Cove Co. Inc. of Spokane, Washington, for the upgrade at Wenatchee Confluence State Park to 50-amp upgrade.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to award the bid to Cove Co. Spokane as presented in resolution 10. Is there further discussion? Hearing none. Those commissioners in favor of the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. Motion is carried. Item 11.
Resolution authorizing additional funds to enabling agreement 06-073 with Pure Technical Incorporated of Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Brett Pickford and Vern Chamberlain will be presenting today.
Vern Chamberlain, Project Management Department Manager.
Brett Bickford, Director of Engineering and Project Management.
This enabling agreement with Pier 06073, Christy Van Wagner and myself manage it. And every year we try to come up with the right amount of, get enough information from staff to predict what we're going to need. And this year we came up a little bit short, so we're asking for a little bit more money. So this resolution requests authorization for additional funds to be spent under the enabling agreement with Pier Technical. The agreement provides an effective method for the district to obtain temporary staffing necessary to accomplish budgeted work when district staff is fully allocated on other projects. This agreement was initiated in 2006, and funds are added each year in an amount equal to what the district staff believes will be required to complete budgeted work. The district initially used Pier to provide construction inspection services only. Now we use them for fish biologists, contract support, specialists, and administrative support. So Brett's going to take it from here on why we need a little bit more this year.
As Vern mentioned, he works with the procurement department to do an estimate in the fall of each year. After the fall estimate was put together, there have been a number of changes in our work scope, as you've heard, through the various months. Some good news in one of these was in our B5 to B8 project. I think it was the same commission meeting that this resolution was presented. We presented a resolution and did a budget revision for the B5 to B8 turbine rehabilitation project. And so after Vern made his estimate, we set the wheels in motion for that project. And that project was started early, so we decided to start that project in May. In the district scorecard, you might note that we've got a metric that we have the stator removed by December, and so I've got some great news to say that that stator's been removed. We've turned that unit over to the contractor, and they're working away on it. So this additional funds helps us to put the inspection in place so that we can support the contractor, as currently they're working 24/7 doing the draft tube modifications. Since most of the funds have been allocated for work, we've also had some other work at the hydros on, and this will allow some money in case we want to hire some extra inspection for what we hope to do, which is to do the winding replacements on C9 and C10.
Comments or questions from commission?
from the public? Hearing none, I'll entertain a motion, please.
Mr. Chairman, I move we accept Resolution 11, a resolution authorizing additional funds to enabling agreement 06-073 with Peer Technical, Inc. of Pond du Lac, Wisconsin.
Is there a second to the motion, please?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to accept Resolution Number 11 as presented. Yeah, that'll keep me from having to pronounce the community in Wisconsin. Any further discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion is carried. Thank you.
Thank you.
Item 13, Commissioner items. And I think, is there a commissioner that's willing to take a look at, from our board workshop together, kind of the direction that we're thinking about going with our commissioner items? And is there one of you that'd be willing to kind of speak to that?
I will, I guess, because it was, I guess I initiated it. I think what we're going to do, instead of every 2 weeks saying, well, this was my last 2 weeks, and on this day I did this, and then at this time I did this, and then I did that, and then follow that up with, and in the next 2 weeks I'm going to do all of this, I just felt like we should approach it differently. That's the way it's always been done. When I first became a commissioner, we were doing it that way, and I just started thinking about it, questioning, is that really, I mean, do you guys really want to hear, and do the folks out there want to hear our every, you know, our daily activities? I don't think so. I kind of often I see some eyes kind of roll, or people maybe half falling asleep. So instead, what we're going to do is mention exceptional items, which is what we do in our balanced scorecard, and I think that's worked out well for our balanced scorecard, and I think that's the approach we're going to take. We'll try it. If Dennis goes to a conference and hears a terrific speaker and wants to share what he learned, you know, great, go for it. Same for all of us. If it's something that we feel like there's real value in sharing it, that's what we'll do. If people are interested in our, you know, our schedules and how many meetings we go to, you know, that's all tracked by Sheila Salmon, our clerk. She tracks everything on the balance scorecard, all the meetings we go to. So if they're interested to see, are they actually attending all these meetings, or what are they doing, they can, you know, folks could look for that there. Does that pretty much cover it?
Yeah, I think so. Carnan, any addition to that?
No, I think I agree with everything the board has decided to do on this. I mean, we thoroughly discussed it at a workshop, and most of the things we do is pretty redundant. And I think the exception for those things that we do outside our normal course of activity is well received at a, you know, in our commission meeting. So I agree with everything Ann said.
Thank you. And I think it falls into, you know, that we're not trying to be less transparent, but actually in many ways more transparent, that, you know, if we do something local or leave the community to do something and it has meaning and relates well to improving things for our customers, this will give us the opportunity to do that rather than a report, an itemized report, calendar dates. Commissioner Travel. Commission travel. I guess it's commissioner travel.
I do have one thing to mention, though.
Yeah, please do.
while Lisa's coming up, I'm leaving tomorrow, tonight, actually. I'm going to be going to Santa Clara for our Northwest Public Power Association Government Relations Committee quarterly meeting. And I'm the vice chair of that committee. And so I'm kind of heading up the resolutions process. And that's what it's going to kind of initiate the resolutions process for 2017. There are 17 resolutions that are archived, which is a lot for Northwest Public Power Association, and so we're going to begin to look at those, consider those, and then consider any new resolutions. So I just thought I would mention that when I get back. If there's anything of particular interest, I'll report on it. But I'll be there for 3 days for that meeting.
Perfect. And that particular committee, I feel, does an excellent job of
summarizing needs, putting them into a resolution format, and getting them before the membership of what, 7 Western states and 1 Canadian province?
I think 8 states.
8 states and 1 Canadian province. So it's a good way to learn what else is going on with other people and to support their concerns as well as ours, having the opportunity to be presented and considered. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah, thanks.
We have in front of us commission travel. Lisa?
Good afternoon. I'm Lisa Sanders, backup clerk of the board, and I manage the commissioner's travel. So before you, you have a summary of travel that's been arranged or still needs to be taken care of between now and the end of the year. So we have Commissioner Congdon, as she said, she's traveling this week. We have Commissioner Bowles and Commissioner Smith traveling for Waputa, 14th through the 16th. September 21 through 23, Commissioner Congdon traveling to Vancouver for the Waputa Water Workshop. In October, Commissioner Congdon traveling to Spokane for NWPPA, the Distributed Energy Resources. October 26, 27, Energy Northwest for Commissioner Berggren and Commissioner Arsenault. I'm not sure yet which hotel we look at for rooms for that, but Carnan, do you know?
They usually have it at the Holiday Inn Express. Angela will make all of the arrangements for that.
Okay. Thank you. We have Commissioner Bowles traveling for Waputa board meeting October 13th. In November, Commissioner Congdon is traveling to Portland for the Women in Public Power Conference. November, we have Waputa meetings. We have hotels held, but I haven't seen the registration forms on those yet, as well as Waputa annual conference, November 30 to December 2. We have rooms. But I haven't seen registration forms yet.
Okay. And then there's one other that's not on here, but it's coming up, and that would be the Mid-Sea Manager Commissioners meeting hosted by Grant County on September 12th. And the question I have is, do we need to set in motion a special meeting? And how many commissioners will actually be in attendance, or could we ascertain that today? I will not be going. I just recently learned that my oldest grandson has a football game that afternoon, and I know where I'm going to be.
I won't be attending. My flight gets into Wenatchee, I think, too late. I think 6:30 or something, 7.
I will be attending.
Okay. Commissioner Arsenault will be attending. A little hard to ask Commissioner Smith today because he's in Kyrgyzstan. And Commissioner Berggren, do you have any idea what your schedule may be on September 12th?
I'm sorry, is that the Mid-Sea?
It is.
Okay. yeah,
I'll
plan on going.
Okay. Well, Commissioner Smith
Sheila,
be back?
Sheila advises that he'll be back.
Okay, so let's go ahead and set this in motion. I think it's an appropriate time to do so. Regarding the conducting of a special meeting at the Mid-Sea Managers Commission meeting, is there a motion to that effect?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to propose a motion to set a special meeting at 5:30 p.m. on Monday, September 12, 2016, for the Mid-Sea Manager Commissioner meeting to be held at the Sunfire Grill in Quincy, Washington.
Is there a second to the motion?
I'll second the motion.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded to hold a special meeting at 5:30 p.m. Monday, September 12, 2016, Mid-Sea Manager Commission meeting held at the Sunfire Grill in Quincy, Washington. Is there discussion? Hearing none, those commissioners in favor of the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, aye. Nay. Motion is carried. Thank you. So we'll get to the second motion toward the end.
Additional matters.
Additional matters. Thank you. So I believe we're probably at item 15. I'm sorry.
If I may, before we please move on, I wanted to make a note to Lisa that on the October 13th Waputa budget meeting that I also will be attending.
Okay.
And we'll need, the meeting starts in the morning, so I will also need accommodations on the 12th.
Okay, I'll get in touch with you for that.
Thank you.
Okay.
And Lisa, I'm questionable on the Waputa annual conference. I'll let you know. Just put a question mark by my name on that, would you?
Okay. So we have a room, and I won't let go of it until you let me know.
Okay. Thanks.
It's definitely better to get that one ahead.
Agreed.
Okay. This time, any other items regarding commission travel? Lisa, Sheila, thank you very much for pulling all this together for us. And we know it's like herding cats, and we appreciate your cat herding abilities.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's required special training and lots of patience. Item 15, follow-up on delegation of action items from previous board meetings.
We had six items that we're following up on. I think you've seen them all. So we're going to get you information about the cumulative savings from conservation over the last 5 years. You got a response from Andrew Grissel on the 15th of August. Question about Lake Chelan being over 9,000 CFS and the revenue equivalent impact of that. Janet Jaspers sent an email on August 17th during that. Overall audit costs of the district, Eric mm-hmm. completed that, sent an email on August 23rd. Clarification on the location of the North Shore substation that Commissioner Congdon wanted. That email went out from Tika Sellers on August 15th. You have a request into us to give you a future update on renewable diesel after the next test of 10,000 gallons. We just have that on the list, and we'll be getting back to you. It'll probably be closer to the end of the year on that one. And you made a request that we inform Suzanne Grissel about the Women in Public Power NWPPA conference on November 8th through 10th, and that has been accomplished.
Great. Very good. Any additions or corrections there? Okay, hearing none, let's take a look at item 16, delegation of action items.
At this point, I'm sorry. Sheila is reminding me that there were two board meetings because you had the board mm-hmm. workshop as well on August 23rd. So follow-up items from that. We needed to send out a special notice for the meeting at the Chelan City Hall and the substation. That was accomplished. Eric Walquist, Randy Smith, and Karna Bergren will meet to discuss the board governance policy. Eric is following up with them, and that was over the next few months.
It was set by Sheila. I think I got the invitation for later this month. So,
okay. It is set. Okay, great. We had a follow-up about how we will pursue radio interviews and commissioner involvement on that. We had an internal discussion about that, and I sent you an email this morning. Just look forward to your response on that as you have time to get to it. Need a quick response. We are following up with Michael Nash. I know that you enjoyed the time with him on how you interact with each other. And so we're looking at a six-month check-in on our top three growth opportunities and his thoughts as well about what activities we might pursue beyond what we did at the August workshop. And any feedback from the subcommittee that will be working on the board governance policy will also be discussed at that next board workshop.
Just for whatever, it was kind of interesting after going through the workshop and then going And, you know, thinking about that for a little bit, to go back and take a look at some of the content of the meeting and reflect more deeply on it. And just some introspection, which is what it was intended to do. And appreciate the opportunity to be there and having the support from the team to continue to do this type of activity. So we're down to additional public.
From this meeting, yeah. We only have one item, and that's for Eric to follow up with Commissioner Arsenault on the rejection process for contracts.
Thank you.
Did we miss anything? Okay.
Additional public comment?
Could we ask you to come on up?
Yeah, come on up.
Well, my name's John Gill. I'm currently a co-employee. I took the layoff. I didn't go back to school. And, of course, I'm interested to see whether or not the plant's going to survive. With all the investments Alcoa has been putting into the business programs in China and buying cheaper aluminum, you can look it up online. Alcoa investment in China, whether or not we stand a chance of reopening our plant. That's just my personal opinion, but when you can divide a company, their downstream and then your upstream, which is the smelters, and then you can invest a lot of money in the Chinese downstream, and they have somewhere around 50 smelters, they're keeping their people working and producing aluminum sometimes at a loss and dumping it on the market, then our company splits and all of a sudden our smelters are closed while theirs are still open. It leaves me scratching my head and wondering why. Now, this is something you look up online. Mm-hmm. Alcoa in China. Now, I don't know all the facts. I don't pretend to. But it's an interesting concept that all at once we divide our company and they're closing down all the smelters in the U.S., or the majority of them, I should say. Strictly my opinion, but something for food for thought for the commissioners to look at. I'm not here to represent the union, nor Alcoa, just as a ratepayer of Chelan County. And because of my age, I'm 62, I chose not to go back to school. And I chose not to retire at this age either. Like most people, I don't like things forced on me. I like retirement decisions should be on my own terms. But once again, I would like perhaps for the commission at least take a look at some of the options that Alcoa has done, or in my opinion have. You can look it up. And I can't sit here and tell you, because I don't want to slander anybody, but it just seems kind of funny that they invested $1 billion into China in 1996. Of course, they sold some of that stock. But now our company split, and our smelters are shut down in the U.S. Something to look at.
Yeah.
Can we take a shot?
Yeah, would you please? Thank you, yeah.
So thank you for the comment. And we will, actually, I'm kind of intrigued by that. We'll take a closer look at that. We did provide a presentation to the Tri-Commission last week on an update of the relationship between Chelan PUD and Alcoa, and I think I could just summarize a couple of the key points there. Number one, the price of aluminum has come up a little bit from where it was when the plant shut down in December, but not very much, and not in the realm of what Alcoa has told us in the past would be necessary for the plant to reopen. And so we certainly are watching that global aluminum price very closely. There is one thing that Chelan PUD can do that helps to make sure that there's an incentive to reopen the plant, and that is the way the contract was drafted, the 2009 contract, it creates a very strong incentive for Alcoa to restart the plant, because
if they stay closed more than 18 months, which will run out in June of 2017, they will pay us roughly $67 million. If they reopen the plant, then they avoid making that payment, and they earn back the $67 million the longer they stay open. So it's not that they can just open for a month and avoid it. They actually earn back through time through the 2027 date. So it's been important to us that we make sure that that provision continues to be enforceable. And the key way we do that is by looking at how the split occurs and making sure that the split of the company does not leave Alcoa in a position where they would be able to avoid making that payment. And so we are very actively engaged in discussion, even today, with Alcoa about how that split will be accomplished and what the implications are for the contract between Chelan PUD and Alcoa, the big Alcoa, the original Alcoa, and the new split company, Alcoa and Arconic, and how that will work. So we intend to continue to report to the community about the progress on those discussions. We are hopeful that we can resolve those within about 30 days, and we will certainly let you and others know about how that goes.
It would be nice. I didn't know that they could earn their money back if they reopened. I was aware of everything else. But I just wanted to highlight that Alcoa has other business ventures. And obviously, if you can buy cheap aluminum from the Chinese, there's no union wages. They don't pay health care. And the Chinese are subsidizing their coal to fire off their plants. We can't compete. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. And we appreciate you being here. It's the value of the workforce at Alcoa has been something that's been revered by this commission. And when the contract was negotiated, the workers were one of our highest priorities in that. And we've tried to honor that piece of it. And certainly appreciate your years of work there and your commitment to the community and value you. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Appreciate You're welcome. We're now up for an executive session.
So this would be a good time, Commissioner, if I might interrupt, to ask for that second motion, changing, as Steve mentioned earlier, the board meeting from the 19th to the 20th.
And thank you for interrupting. I was just moving right on through.
Mr. Chairman, I move we change the Monday, September 19, 2016 regular meeting to Tuesday, September 20, 2016. The meeting will begin at 10 a.m. with a study session.
Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to change the Monday, September 19th, 2016 regular meeting to Tuesday, September 20th, 2016. The meeting will begin at 10 a.m. with a study session. Is there discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor of supporting the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
And then, Commissioner, yes, now the executive session, and we will need a motion to authorize Commissioner Berggren to participate in the executive session by telephone.
Okay. I so move.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to permit Commissioner Berggren to attend the executive session by telephone. And those in favor of the motion as presented, if there's no further discussion, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
Thank you.
We need about 15 minutes.
Okay. So can we come back at 2? Okay, it's an opportunity to move into executive session to discuss with legal counsel the enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation, which the district or its board is likely to become a party, authorized by RCW 4230-1101I, for approximately 15 minutes, starting at 2 o'clock. So let's move into recess reconvene at 2, please. Thank you. This is Chelan County PUD Commission at September 6, 2016, coming out of executive session where no decisions were reached. And is there any other items of business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we are adjourned.